Open up the House Interim Committee on Human Services and Housing on December 9th, 2014. And you can see we've asked people to pull up the screen because we asked for no PowerPoints. Unfortunately, I didn't ask early enough, and I apologize for that, for not alerting you earlier. But I hate them. Anyway, so we're not going to have PowerPoints. We have a very full agenda, so we're going to ask people to give us important information quickly so we can move on. So we appreciate all of you coming, being prepared, and helping us be prepared, too. So thank you very much. This will be an informational hearing, so it is invited testimony only. And I'm going to be asking Dr. Chris Ferrantinos and Deborah Friedman and Mike Morris to all come up at once, because what we're going to be talking about is the USDOJ opinion about mental health, the mental health system. So thank you so much for coming today. And just start and telling us what it is you want us to know. And I know you have some printed material, and we will make sure that everybody gets this. Either you or Christy can send it out to all of our committee members. Thank you so much. So go ahead.
Okay, so is it okay? Can I have a
yes.
Here? All right. So my name is Chris Ferrantinos. I'm the director for behavioral health for Legacy Health. And I'm here.
Could you pull back just a little bit? You don't need to be all that close
okay.
to the mic.
Like this?
Right.
Great.
Okay. So I'm here to. Okay, got it. I'm here to talk about a project that we have been developing in response to the issue of overcrowding and boarding of psychiatric and behavioral health patients in emergency departments. And not only that, but also in response to the need that we see in our community. Basically, we set out to find out what were the best and evidence-based practices that were out there to respond to this, and we found a model that it's been functioning in Alameda County, California, for the last 10 years. And basically, it has three components of a psychiatric emergency service that we thought at Legacy that would be excellent for the metro area and possibly other places in the state of Oregon. Number one, it's because it's a very humane way of treating patients. Patients are admitted to the psychiatric emergency service and assessed and treated immediately by experts that are 24/7 available to do so. Also, they stay not in separate rooms, seclusion rooms. They stay in a more of a living room, kind of open milieu, if you will, with recliners, with a lot of interaction with staff, with nurses, psychiatrists, social workers. So that was the first aspect of that. The second one that was very attractive was the fact that was had very good outcomes in terms of avoiding unnecessary hospitalizations. So about 25% of the patients do end up having to go to inpatient hospital, but 75% are returned to the community within 24 hours. So it's kind of an observation status in which you can actually about a day, if you will, to really make sure that you're doing everything before that patient is deemed to be necessary to go to an inpatient psychiatric unit. And thirdly, it was sustainable through a Medicaid code that it's active and used in the state of California and Nebraska. Those are the two states that I know that are using.
And tell us why it's important to have the right Medicaid code so that the federal government can pay for some of this.
So right now what happens is if a patient goes to an emergency department, a regular emergency department, you get one charge. So the hospitals can basically have one charge for that patient. Now, to remind you what's happening with our psychiatric behavioral health patients, they stay in the hospital a lot longer. Their average length of stay at Legacy is about 16 hours compared to in an emergency room, more physical health patient stays about 2 hours. So what that means, it's unsustainable to actually have to create a staff of experts that can respond to those crises. Without a longer way of sustaining it over time. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
But also the federal government helps pay. If it's Medicaid, then they will help pay for
of
that.
Of course, of
yes.
course.
And yeah. I just want to make that clear. I think yeah. the committee realizes that, but I just want to emphasize that's one of the important issues, because then, like in the, when people go to the state hospital here in Salem, that the state pays out of general fund, pays for those patients. Isn't that accurate? Thank you.
Right. So it's sustainable through federal and state match.
Thank you.
There are two other aspects of this project that I would like to share with you. One, it's very based on decriminalization of psychiatric emergencies. Right now, if a person is having a psychiatric emergency, it's roaming the streets and psychotic and needing some help, the police many times is called, puts that person in the back of a police car, sometimes, you know, with handcuffs, and then take them to the hospital. And the police is really not in the business of medical emergencies. So what they do in California, that has been very in that county, that has been very effective, is the police has worked out agreements with EMS to actually call the ambulance, and then the ambulance comes to the scene and does a medical screening, and then at that point there's a decision making point where the EMS worker decides, is this patient a patient to go to a psychiatric emergency or a regular ED? Do they need medical clearance? They do a protocol in the field, and then the patient is transported by an ambulance. So it's a decriminalization of psychiatric emergencies.
So what I remember from the letters that have gone from the U.S. Department of Justice for several years now is that they were really emphasizing a place where people could be dropped off, where they could come themselves to get crisis services, and also a place where the police, the public safety folks, can drop off a patient. And so I think what you're talking about is a program through Legacy, right, that will go in what is the hospital? Holiday
Park.
Right,
uh-huh.
right. So this is not exactly what the US DOJ had envisioned. Isn't that accurate? And I'm going to ask each of you to introduce yourselves, because I might ask each of you a question. So, Mike.
For the record, my name is Mike Morris, and I'm Policy Administrator with the Addictions and Mental Health Division.
Thank you.
And for the record, I am Deborah Friedman. I'm the Behavioral Health Director at HealthShare of Oregon.
Thank you.
So, with all due respect, I would love if we could get rid of the term drop-off center, because we don't drop off people that have heart attacks, do we? I mean, it's just not really a concept. I think we would like to, I would like to sort of campaign to say that we want to provide, take the person that needs care to the facility that provides that care, the right person, the right time, the right facility. So even though, so this is not a drop-off center, it is a facility that provides the care that individuals in with a behavioral health crisis need that care. So and so it responds to that need, but it's not a drop-off center. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, but I still have some questions about that, because that's one of the things we'd heard from the public safety folks, is that when somebody is having a crisis, or when somebody, a family member, or the member themselves realize that they're having a crisis, they need some place to go for treatment. Like, so now if somebody has a heart attack, they know where to go. So I think that's one of the things that we looked at with public safety, is where does somebody go now who's having a mental health crisis?
And they would be, these individuals, families, would be able to walk in to be brought by family to this psychiatric emergency service, just like they are right now to an emergency department. This psychiatric emergency service would respond to the community very much like an emergency room responds now.
And then what would happen?
Well, and then the other piece that is part of this larger puzzle of providing a more holistic care is assessing, starting a treatment plan with the patient right there and then, seeing if they can improve within 24 hours and be returned to the community, and if not, admitting them into an inpatient bed. However, the part of the vision is also to make this place be a hub for community-based organizations to have their staff working with our social workers to help navigate these patients back into services that they need. Because one of the things that happens now, and we all work in the field and we know, it's a lot of individuals fall through the cracks in between handoffs. And providing a more warm handoff, a navigation of that process, if you will, through discharge and transitions of care is part of the vision. We're actually envisioning building a facility where there's a place in which community-based organization workers are actually there working with the patients, helping them transition out back to the community.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to follow up. What county is that in California that's doing that right now with the EMS response?
It's the Alameda County.
Oh,
there are
okay.
several cities around that have agreed
yeah,
on that.
Right, the mm-hmm. metropolitan area there. Okay. And then also, what type of training,
follow-up?
What kind of training are the EMS personnel receiving to recognize that for the mental health issue?
Well, there is a protocol for medical clearance, and there is also a training that the police actually get insofar recognizing behavioral health crisis. So it's a combination of the training of EMS and police recognizing that that person should actually be brought to a psychiatric emergency service.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions while we've stopped here? Okay, go ahead. Did you want to add to this?
Just to say that...
And tell us your name again,
sorry.
Please.
This is Deborah Friedman with HealthShare of Oregon. Just to add that HealthShare of Oregon is very excited about the development of a psychiatric emergency services program, as described by Dr. Ferrantinos. We believe that it's an important component of the healthcare system that doesn't exist today that will respond much more appropriately to our members and other individuals in the community that are experiencing psychiatric mental health crises. And we are committed to funding this service when it is available for our members.
That's great. Thank you. Mike?
Again, my name is Mike Morris, and I'm Policy Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. And so just to finish up as far as comments regarding the emergency services is that there is a meeting that happens on a monthly basis with Portland Police and the folks here at the table, and as well as U.S. DOJ has a representative there, and where we're actively discussing this and how this fits into the continuum of care. So there's a lot of collaboration across the board. And so USDOJ is fully aware of what is happening in that regards. And then I can go ahead into an update on the...
Sure. We're going to give you a total of 5 more minutes, okay?
Okay. And so just to clarify, the Portland Police have a settlement agreement with U.S. Department of Justice regarding their issues. And then... the state of Oregon has an open investigation with the U.S. Department of Justice for looking at our community mental health system for in regards to Olmstead issues. Mm-hmm. And so that's ongoing. We have a letter of agreement with them, and we're going into the third year of that 4-year agreement. The first 2 years were primarily setting up a data matrix and collection of data and then reporting that data. And we're going into the third year of beginning to talk about targets and how will we know we have made progress in those different areas. And so in October 17th, we submitted our first report based upon the new negotiated data matrix. It's a narrative report with a bunch of data tables. The narrative report provides a lot of graphs to illustrate what's really happening. It is based on the new matrix, and it includes the last 2 quarters of 2013 and then the first quarter of 2014. There are some things that we're looking at that we already identify as concerns, but it's still, we're trying to, 3 points, it's really hard to tell if there are certain trends that we need to look for. So we're there are some things that we have like a yellow flag on to keep an eye on. And then also, because it only covers the first quarter of 2014, we had from the legislature the significant investment in the community mental health system, and that was just getting off the ground in that first quarter. And so we're really anticipating in the second and the subsequent quarters that our data will demonstrate the results of those investments. And so we're looking forward to being able to report that to the U.S. Department of Justice. We've been continuing to have regular meetings. We met over the summer. We had another meeting at the beginning of November to review this report. They were very pleased with finally having a set of data that they feel like they can monitor what's happening. We feel good about the data that it will be able to provide us some direction and also be able to monitor what's happening in our system. And so we, like I said, we're beginning to talk about targets, and we meet with them again next week for a couple of days to start discussing and, to be honest with you, negotiating targets to see if we can identify those targets and then monitor our progress over the next couple of years, the balance of the 2 years of our agreement. Also, our report is posted on our website, and so it's available to the public. So,
thank you, Mike. I think it's, Representative Greenland.
Now, what are some of the elements of that, those data reports?
There is like, just to give you a sense, there's like 28 different graphs that we have in the report. We provide some data regarding the state hospital, average daily population for the different populations. We have data regarding acute care admissions. We also have readmission rates for state hospitals as well as acute care, follow-up after acute care. We monitor the number of mobile crisis events, and services that are delivered, served community treatment teams, the services, number of people being served, supported employment, a whole host of our services, as well as types of housing that we're providing. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I think it's been somewhat confusing and frustrating in our committee over the last few years hearing it's the state's problem, it's the county's problem, it's the city's problem, it's the CCO's problem. And I think it's somewhat gratifying to finally see that people are working together. It's been somewhat frustrating also to hear, we're having meetings, and to hear that something is actually going to be on the ground is very gratifying. And I'm going to be depending on you, since as you know, this will be my last day here, that I'm going to be depending on all of you to be following up on this, or I will come down and haunt you. As well as them. So, and I also want to say publicly,
in the spirit of mental health path.
In the Portland Tribune, there was a comment made that the crisis centers and mobile crisis centers and crisis drop-off centers, according to Portland, are aspirational. I want to make a public statement that in the letter from the U.S. Department of Justice, it was not aspirational. It is expected that that will happen. So I at least want it to come from this desk that that is expected. It is not aspirational, folks, and I hope Amanda Marshall is watching this. Any other questions or comments? Thank you so much, and thank you for working so hard and working together.
And just last comment, Chair Tomei. I just want to personally thank you for your work in advocating for people with behavioral health disorders over your time here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you for your work, all of you. Thank you. Okay, this is speed dating, folks. So we're going to be hearing next from the CASA Study Committee report. Hi, Jack. Are they here? If they're not here, we're moving on.
They're here. I think they're outside, though.
Why would you be outside? Come on in, quickly.
You ready for the
CASA? CASA, yes.
Yep.
So quickly sit down and introduce yourselves. We have a very long, difficult agenda, and so we're asking people to move on. So we have, I think, maybe 10 minutes for you. Can you do that in 10 minutes?
Yes.
Thank you.
My name is Cynthia Easterday. I'm a Yamhill County Circuit Court judge. It's my honor and privilege to be here today to talk to you about CASA. And I just want to, I'm going to just give you a brief history and background, how we got here today. As you know, CASA has been in Oregon for about 25, 30 years. And as a judge, I just can't express the importance that CASAs have in the courtroom. So our goal eventually is that every child in foster care, will have a CASA. So for about 20 years, the CASA was administered and managed by the Commission for Children and Families. And then, as you recall, in 2011, the commission dissolved. And in 2012, House Bill 3102 was passed that required a CASA task force to be formulated and for us to study and make recommendations as to where CASA would best be managed. And so I was part of that task force along with Senator Boquist and Representative Thompson and attorneys from across the state and CASA directors. And we met every few months and we, in the end, decided to recommend the Oregon Volunteers Commission, which we were delighted. I don't know that anybody really expected that to come out of our task force, but it did come out and we were thrilled. That is their expertise. And we just made that recommendation, and as, of course, as you recall, in 2012, House Bill 4802 was passed, and that's, of course, moved to the Oregon Volunteers Commission, but also, again, there was a request for a study committee to be formulated, and I was part of that as well. So I was a part of the task force, and then I was part of the study committee. So for the last 3 years, I've been meeting every few months to study where would be the best place for CASA. And so we've been meeting for the last 2 years, every few months, and again, and reviewing. So I think the delightful part about this whole process is that everybody, no matter what, that our positions are not always aligned, our goals are the same, and that is that we just hope someday that every child in foster care will have a CASA to advocate for their best interests. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning. I'm Brian Cox, and I'm a practicing attorney. I've been a volunteer since I was a teenager continuously. Been a CASA since 2007, a peer coordinator. Was appointed to the Oregon Volunteers Commission as a commissioner when CASA became part of the commission, and now I serve as a co-chair. I also got asked to serve on this work group, and I'm always flattered and a little humbled when I get asked to sit at the Smart Kids table, and it was that. I really appreciate the people I got to work with. It was a huge advantage to our work to have Judge Easterday there. She was part of the original group. We also had Barbara Johnson, who, previous CASA director, recently helped with the transition of a local program. She serves on the commission as a representing CASA programs as well. Kathleen and Maria Hine, great help, workhorses, intellectually and imaginatively helpful to in ways that are hard to describe. We did a lot of work. We looked at a lot of views. We took in a lot of information, and we spoke with a lot of, or gathered information from a lot of key stakeholders. From that, we came to the recommendation that the state should adopt a graduated approach to administering state funds by a process that transfers those funds in bulk to the OCN through a single source contract.
OCN.
I said OCN, I thought.
You do. Tell them it's the...
The Oregon CASA Network.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
You get fined for acronyms in some rooms in this building.
Nice acronym. Our study group and our task... Thank you. And if I slip, please laugh again. Our study group focused on identifying the most appropriate structure for operation for funding and administering the state funds for CASA programs. You know, we had an eye towards two things. How do we best serve the kids? How do we meet the responsibilities to the taxpayers? Say we did this in a fiscally responsible manner. We were always in concert in goal with the Oregon CASA Network in the sense that this is the model that we support from the beginning and the end, and that's notwithstanding the fact that we looked at all other possibilities we can identify, all other stakeholders who were willing to talk to us, and all of the issues that we could identify for this process. In doing that, really, the only difference we came to was differences in timing, and I think the recommendation that we brought to the committee addresses that. Our hope is that as the state progresses towards a model utilizing Oregon Volunteers as a pass-through entity for a single-source contract within OCN within two or three legislative cycles. Since our process was new and there's no administrative rules in place, our group investigated this by looking at other national giving models, standards, practices, and similar types of approaches that are accepted in similar situations. And looking at those, we came to a number of constructs that we hope that this recommendations include. We'd like to see the Oregon CASA network meet three consecutive financial audits without major findings. We'd like to see evidence of sufficient infrastructure to carry out the terms of the contract, and these are all more outlined in the report we've submitted. And then we'd like to see evidence of successful prior contract management experience. That'll explain a little more about that in a moment. And successful completion of no less than three state grants for services.
Brian, I think you weren't here when I said this is a speed dating situation today because we have so much on our calendar. So you have two more minutes for the two of you.
You're going to see how fast I'm going to skip it.
Okay.
I would like to make a point of looking towards CASA's success and sharing a moment of tremendous progress where they've recently their success in advocating for $900,000 secured in the governor's budget for CASA. Being aware of several concerns that have been raised, the recommendation addresses those, makes specific recommendations for meeting those concerns for the local programs. The committee recognizes that the Oregon CASA network has made great strides in meeting many of those concerns and will continue to do so. After this process, we've made a recommendation for appropriate structure and funding and administration of CASA programs through Oregon volunteers to Oregon CASA network through a single contract model. I'm sorry.
Kathleen?
With that, I'd like to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And for inviting us to speak.
And thank you for your time and commitment to this project. Go ahead.
I was just here to answer any questions that you all might have.
Bless your heart. We thought you did.
And to thank you for the care that this committee has given to this process. And to really say to you, Representative Tomei, thank you very much for the time you put in as chair of this committee to help us get to this point today.
Thank you for that, and I thank all of you CASA volunteers. This is such a tremendous problem. I used to be a social worker, and I worked with CASA volunteers, and it's, and we both know, working on this committee, how important this is. So thank you so much. Any further comments or questions?
Have Kathleen put her name on the record.
Oh, Kathleen, could you give us your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, Kathleen Joy, Executive Director, Oregon Volunteers. And any of us are available to answer any questions that you all might have about the report at any time.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
See, I should have gotten questions.
Okay. Speed dating, moving along. Oh, Jack Roberts from the Lottery Commission.
You might want to review this.
Thank you for coming today.
Thank you for the invitation.
You're welcome.
For the record, I'm Jack Roberts, the executive director of the Oregon Lottery. And you'd asked me to come and talk about some issues that have been raised regarding our setting commission rates. And
right.
I assume you all saw the article that was in the Oregonian. First thing I want to make clear is that we don't have a plan for what we're going to do with rates. The way the system works is that I make a recommendation to the commission. They make the decision. And we've been talking and we've been going through some processes. I will be glad to share with you today what my current thinking is. I can assure you that I don't know where the five commissioners are. And in fact, I can't tell you specifically where any one of them is on where this is going to go. But to address some of the things that were in the article, and you'd give me a list of questions, which I will.
And I think everybody got the questions, didn't you, over your email grid?
Did you get? Now, I also brought other handout. Have you?
And
seen,
I think we.
One is a list of the 100 leading video lottery retailers.
Right.
And see that. And then I also include, because there's been a question about how often have rates been reduced. And I gave you a sheet that shows the history of video lottery since it started and what's happened with commission rates. And
I think they were emailed to you, but I don't think
I have copies if anybody needs them. Should I just
here,
have those? Yes,
thank you, Jack.
But basically, what the state of Oregon did when we adopted video lottery in 1991 We started with a fairly high rate. We were somewhat following the model. South Dakota beat us by 2 years. They had used this. So you start with a high rate, and then over time, it's been reduced. South Dakota today has a flat rate of 22.5%. They also allow video retailers to have 25 machines. And the more machines you have, the more money you can make from a lower flat rate. Our model is a different one, and as you can see from the history, what's happened is that we have a lot of small retailers. We started out with a limit of 5 machines back in the time of the recession, back around 2005. The decision was made to allow those who have high volume, if they wish, to add a 6th machine. And we also looked at, as we've shown here historically, reducing those rates, but keeping them higher for the low volume retailers. And in fact, for a number of years, we've had 2 rates, and people are asked at the beginning of the year to pick which one they have, and once you pick it, you're stuck with it for the year, so you try to guess right. For really large retailers and really small retailers, it's an easy decision. For some of those in the middle, it's very difficult. And when I came here almost exactly a year ago, started on December 2nd last year, one of the things that I found is that we had a very demoralized retailer base. People who felt that over the years, and it's not just us, it's a combination of what's happened with the economy, what's happened with some of the regulations and laws that govern them, but they have felt that over the years we continue to cut their rates. And in particular, as you can see in the, if you fall through the fine print there in the story about how it grew, when they decided to add line games and add the 6th machine, we did see a big spike in revenue. And they set rates based on certain expectations, but said, but if we exceed this level, we'll come back and cut them again. They did exceed that level. They did come back and cut them again. And that was followed shortly after that with the Great Recession that we hit. Also, just coincidentally, at the same time that we decided to ban indoor smoking, which I think we all agree was a great public policy decision, but it had an impact on their revenue. And so what they had called the look back on the revenue when the spike was not followed by another look back after the decline. And that's why in 2010 it was fairly contentious. There were a group of people who were saying then that we should continue to cut the rates, that they could get by on less. But they were also asking for more. And what the commission and the director at that time did was say, why don't we just hold the course, which I think was a prudent decision then. But the word from the lottery retailers is what you'll see is you'll have declining retailers and you'll see a lack of new investment and growth. And
why would the retailers decline? Because it just takes a small space, like in a restaurant or a bar. It takes a small space, and in some ways, that's free money for them. So why would they say, I don't want these anymore?
I don't think we had many, if any, examples of people saying, come take our machines. What we have is businesses fail.
Right.
And new businesses coming in are increasingly not asking for lottery, because what they're hearing from people is this negativity of people who have had experience with the lottery. We've seen OLCC applications growing, and our retail base has remained constant or slightly declining during the last contract period of five.
But, you know, please join me, folks. But when this first passed, it became a constitutional amendment, right, to allow this?
Not the video. The lottery itself was a constitutional
amendment. The lottery itself, right. So there's only so much the legislature can do. I realize that. But when it was first passed by the people in Oregon, it was to bring in money for schools and then development of businesses and then later parks.
Originally, it was just for economic development. When we passed video lottery in 91, it was right after we passed Measure 5. We then tried to get a sales tax and lost 75-25. Then in 1995, it was referred to the voters, and the Constitution was amended to allow it to be used for schools, and that passed with 85% of the vote.
Right. So people see it going to schools, not to keep a business going, a tavern or a bar or a Dottie's or Foxy's, which really are just mini casinos. So I have a hard time understanding why we've sort of changed that attitude rather than supporting education and economic development in parks. Instead, we have some obligation to support the businesses.
From my perspective, we don't have an obligation to support the businesses. We have an obligation to maximize revenue for the state.
Right.
They are our service delivery system. They're our partners in this. And that's why there's a lot of, I think, misunderstanding that we even have as an agency over the years. We're different than the OLCC. We're not licensing people to operate. They don't have a legal entitlement. They're our business partners, and in fact, our contracts are set up in a way that either party can terminate on 14 days' notice. And we're set up that way because we're using them to house our machines, to operate our business, and for that we pay them a commission.
Right,
and
the commission they don't decide after a certain point, and you said that they don't decide to take out the machines. They're too much of a bother to me. But you're saying that the new people coming on with OLCC licenses are not choosing to do this. So what my point is that it's not a negative to have these in their businesses, the people, Dotties and Foxies and all the Sherry's at the airport and all these places that I have no idea who they are. My point is they like having the machines in there, so why would you want to give them more money? Because it's more of a
mission. Again, we haven't decided whether to do that or not. What's under consideration, what I would tell you that I'm looking very seriously at is to have a single unified rate, not force them to choose at the beginning of the year whether they want to pick one or the other. Keep the same rates for the first part of up to $175,000 of gross, they get 27.5%. And then up from there to $475,000, they get 23%. Under the current system, if they've chosen that option, they then go down to 14%. And that's where we have heard from retailers say, when we get to 14%, we start cutting back our hours, we start laying off some of our people, we are reducing.
Because they're depending on that for their business. I guess that's my point.
Well, it's not just depending on that, but that doesn't affect your profit margin and the money that you're making.
Representative Gumberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Director Roberts, for being here. If I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that we're not seeing a decline in the number of machines per business, but rather a decline in the number of businesses that have machines. And I just wanted to make sure I understood what you were perhaps saying between the lines. Were you suggesting that some of these businesses failed because of the rate of return on the machines that they had?
Businesses grow and decline all the time. And you have to replace if you're trying to use this as our business model for how we deliver our services and make the money for the schools and the parks and economic development, we have to replenish that. We were, before we had this big bubble with the changes to the games where we had the line mission games and that, we were growing about 4 or 5%. That's frankly what seems to be happening in the non-lottery gaming businesses now, including the tribal casinos. And we're seeing that in other types of entertainment. We're growing about 1%. So we're thinking we're not replenishing that because we're not invigorating our and I tell you, we did go around the state and talk to retailers, and they basically seem to be fairly demoralized and unhappy with their relationship. They weren't turning in their machines. But our job here is to try to say what would give us a better growth. And so if I can sort of get back to the narrative of the small people, we want to leave kind of as they are, extend that to everyone, and then have a flat 20%. When I say we, I mean, this is sort of my thought about it, and we'll see whether the commissioners like that or don't like it. There are other strategies that would, in fact, reduce rates, and we may end up adopting those. But as I think most of you may remember, because the legislature approved it, we're investing $225 million in replacing all of our machines because they're becoming antiquated. We should replace them earlier. We didn't because we actually gave excess transfers to the state during the recession to help moderate, which we have done in each of our recessions since we had video lottery. So now we're going in and making this. It's going to upgrade them. We're going to have a better network. We're going to be able to do a lot of things that help us be more efficient, more effective. But it's also going to incur some costs on the part of the retailers. Part of our thought is,
but it costs them.
Well, they're going to have to come and make some changes to bring in the new line. They have to pay for some of the work in their equipment and machines there. They may, in some cases, because some of these machines are larger, make some. I'm not talking about huge figures.
The machines are owned by the Lottery Commission, right?
Right.
And the upkeep is done by the Lottery Commission,
yes.
Right? So it's really not much of an expense for it.
No, but we are asking them to make some new investments. And frankly, I would like to have them, and we have the ability in our contract, tell them to upgrade their their sites and do that. I'm not talking about a huge economic burden. I'm saying we're asking more of them. We're asking them to do better. And part of what I would like to do is consider, how do we take away the disincentive of having our rates drop to 17.5% and 14% and even 11%, even though no one, they always, for some reason, their business stops growing before they get down to the 11% rate. So there are clearly some disincentives there.
Excuse me, Representative Kelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that you're upgrading all of the machines, and we've had a lot of hearings in this committee about machines, and one of the questions that I had asked of your predecessor was why we aren't investing in machines in the technology that helps with gaming addiction, where people can kind of sign up to lock themselves out after a particular period of time or set a limit of either time or dollars. And we were told that there wasn't a replacement planned. But now that there's a replacement, will the lottery be investing in those tools as there's a new fleet of machines that are
what we're doing does enable that, because the network that we have connected right now, we're connected by what are sort of dated, old-fashioned data cables that are becoming obsolete. Now it'll be Ethernet systems. It's really like with computers, and exactly what you're talking about, self-exclusion or reminders, interruption, those things, that technology will be available to us when we upgrade this.
And the machines themselves, so it's both the connection, but the machines themselves have to be embedded with that technology.
We're calling machines are basically video terminals. They're computers, and they can do any of those things. The problem has always been we haven't had the connection that could do that, and we will. And that is part of what we're working on. In fact, we have been working very hard on the whole issue of problem gambling. Thanks to Representative Tomei for the session, we gained some of our ability to do that. But we also, there was a bill that she and I worked on that we couldn't get through the Senate, but I told you we were going to be implementing that, and we are implementing that. We have a code of practice, but we're also talking to our retailers saying we want to engage you in this. And one of the things that we would like to do, we're talking to the OLCC, we want to have servers. You have to go take a test and get training to deal with problem drinkers. We want to add the problem gambling component to that, and to do that. So we are asking of our retailers to participate. And frankly, most of them are very supportive of that, and they want to do it. But the technology change you're talking about specifically is something that, with the replacement, we'll have the capacity to do, and we'll have to work through on which the best ones are to use. Frankly, the Canadians are ahead of us on that, and so we're getting a chance to learn from what works and what doesn't work there. But we absolutely are working on that.
And one more follow-up? I think the Australians are doing a pretty good job of that, too. Would it be possible for us to come, or those of us that are interested, to come and see this technology on the machines? Do you have it ready to go so we can see how it's working? And will it be in all retailers? Will that be required across all video lottery machines in the state?
I mean, whatever we decide, and we haven't, again, the commission will make an ultimate decision on what we can do, and it'll depend on the technology available at the time, what we require. But whatever we do, there are machines. We'll do what we want to with our machines, and we run them, we operate. That is one of the advantages of the system we have, in addition to being more profitable than, for example, South Dakota, where they have operators who own that, and they get the profit from that, so that their transfers are about 50% of their sales, and ours is about 60%. But part of the advantage we get from that is that we control it, and we will control it, and we will move forward with that. And that's the other
all the machines. I didn't hear that answer.
Yes, no,
that's the decision. Will be all the machines will have that capability.
Yeah. I can't think of any reason why everyone's hooked up to the same network. They're all basically the same machines. They are our machines. We have control over it. No one has the option to veto what we do with our machines. That's the relationship that we have. And so, yes, we're definitely looking at moving forward and doing that, and we'll be glad to keep you posted on what we're doing and what the latest thinking is and moving.
I'm going to follow up on that question. So will all the machines have the stopping the machine after a while and saying, you've been doing this for a half hour, you've been playing this game for 2 hours, or will they choose to do that at the beginning of play?
We don't know how the system is going to set up, because it's how we set up, but we are the ones who have control over that. It's the lottery, it's not the individual retailers. And
appreciate
but
that.
I'll tell you, there is some feedback we've heard from folks in Canada that a lot of people don't like self-exclusion. Some of the casinos in Illinois, I understand, are doing it where they've made it. I guess it's not technically a crime; it's a violation. But people are being fined for coming in and trying to play when they have that. I'm not sure in Oregon we're going to go that far, but where we go and what we do will be a decision that the lottery makes, and we certainly will.
I can appreciate that, but I didn't hear the answer to my question. So, will it automatically have this ability to after a certain period of saving. Well,
the machines don't automatically have anything.
But will it automatically happen because the lottery commission decides that, or will the player decide that I want these reminders?
That will be a decision that the commission will make at the time these are implemented, and from time to time we'll make that decision. But we have the control. The control is with the lottery. It's not, if we decide to allow the players to make that decision or not, with some information, that decision will be made at the time. But the capacity is there with these new machines to do that kind of programming.
Madam Chair, one more question.
Follow up.
Under the constitutional restrictions, could the legislature direct that to happen on all machines by statute?
I don't want to be in a position of trying to give you legal advice on what you can't or can't do. It's that probably your legislative counsel might tell you what you can. But frankly, I think the legislature does have broad authority over the types of gaming activity that are run in the state. So we will, I guess, have to deal with that when the time comes.
But I am hearing you say on the record that is an investment that you're already planning to make in the technology to be able to do that. So if there was such a bill, there wouldn't be a giant fiscal from the agency because it's already in your budget in this upgrade to put the technology in place to be able to have the exclusion technology in every machine in the state.
I never want to try to guess what fiscal impact anything may have, but I will tell you, answer your question. Our understanding, our intention, and what we're doing and what we're buying, we're told that we'll be able to do that. And that's one of the things that is important to us, to have that capacity. Whether ultimately the decision is made to do it in a certain way or certain, that's still evolving and changing. And we have Richard Volberg, who is a national authority and who we had helping us on our problem gambling code of conduct, is also going to be doing a prevalent study here in Oregon, and she's agreed to consult, and she's worked with some of these, and she has seen some of the problems they've run into in certain places, and so we're going to continue to, that's a work in progress, but the legislature's input is always invited. You may very well have the authority to do something if you can pass a bill that tells us what to do, but as I told Representative Tomei, when we couldn't get the Senate to approve her bill, I said we have the authority to basically implement that anyway, and that's what we're doing.
Thank you, Jack. You've been very cooperative and helpful on it. I think it's sort of a contentious relationship here. Those of us who want to see more money going into education, it's somewhat galling to see the millions and millions and millions of dollars that go into commissions.
Well, if I could just sort of close the loop here on what the most that is under consideration here is to basically get to 20% and stop there. If that had no impact on growth, and no impact, and we looked at just a static analysis on what happened last year, commissions in total would go up by $5.6 million. Now, that sounds like a lot of money. It's 1.25% of our total revenue. And so what we're talking about having the growth to overcome that is another 1.5 or 2%. In addition, if that happened and we're concerned, well, that money's going to come out of schools, we have a figure that we get from DAS, from the legislature, of our transfers. And our job is to meet that. If we don't generate enough revenue, we have a contingency fund set aside, which is adequately funded to be able to make up a $5 or $6 million shortfall. At the end of this last fiscal year, it's $93 million. And we added, I think, about $18 million last year. So we have the capacity to deal with this. It's not going to cost schools money. The question is, what going forward is going to give us the best opportunity to have the revenue grow with the needs for funding for schools and parks, not the whole state budget, schools and parks and economic development. And if we could return back to a growth rate of somewhere more in the 4 to 5% range rather than the 1 to 2% range, we think we can do that. And I think it's a reasonable investment. If we're going to make a $225 million investment in the machines, making potentially $5 or $6 million investment in our retailers to help get them on board when we're going to be asking more of them, I think is worth considering.
But we know one of the reasons that the lottery's amount is going down is because people on their little phones and on their computers at home, that kind of gambling is very prevalent. And so I think there's no guarantee that the amount that we get from the lottery is going to be increasing in any time soon. And I think we, as a legislature, give the lottery a very mixed message. On one hand, we say, give us as much money as you can for schools and economic development and parks, but don't let anybody be addicted. Mm-hmm. And even though we provide money for addiction treatment, of course, the most effective, efficient, and humane idea is to not let people get addicted in the beginning. So it concerns me a whole lot that when I read in the paper about some of these Dotties and Foxies, et cetera, want to go more into the strip malls. That's where people stop on their way home, and that's where they use their paycheck. So that does not thrill me a whole lot. So, again, I'm going to be here in spirit only, not in body, and I'm hoping that your spirits will be following on, that we can keep on nagging poor Jack, who is so kind. You're so good to come here, Jack, and I really appreciate it. And I appreciate your emotional investment as well as your intellectual investment in all this. And I know Representative Greenlick has a question, and then Representative Kenny Geyer.
Yeah, I'll be following your spirit on this one. I hate the lottery, frankly. I think we're addicted to it, and I think we ought to find a way to deal with our addiction to those lottery revenue and get rid of the lottery. I have a secret plan for doing that, but that I'll reveal when the time is right.
Good.
But I'm a little concerned looking at these top 100 numbers, because I thought the idea was always to have the lottery being incidental to another business. And it's very clear to me looking at this lottery. At Dottie's, say, for example, I don't know what the number is, but I would estimate $3 or $4 million a year in revenue, maybe more, maybe $5 million. We've created some virtual casinos, and I don't think that was ever our intention. And is there any way to deal with it? I see. I don't know what Dottie's total revenue is. Perhaps you know off the top.
If you look at all the chains together, we don't gross that up. We could calculate that, but we.
I was calculating an estimate of maybe $4 to $5 million a year. They don't really do any other business.
$6.2 million, Dottie's.
Oh, all right. I was a million off. So. I mean,
we get about 80% of that.
Yeah, but I don't think that was ever our intention.
Well, first I
that was in commissions, Jack. $6.2 million in commissions.
Okay. Well, then that means that we get four times that amount to the state. So it would be 24.
But that's not your profit, is it? Isn't it after you pay off the winnings, et cetera?
No, on video, this is all net of winnings. I mean, really, if you really start looking at the numbers, we show about $742 million is the net that we divide up with the. Retailers with commissions, but people are playing about $2.5 billion, and the net coming out of that is this is a huge business. It's interesting when I met with Governor Kitzhaber and he offered me this job, he led off the discussion saying that he didn't vote for the lottery when it was on the ballot in 1984, and I answered that I didn't either, and I think both of us believed that there was a better way to organize our tax system, and 30 years later we're both still waiting for that better way to do that. But in the meantime, the only replacement revenue we have passed for schools since Measure 5 passed is video lottery. And we have, and since then we've added Measure 47 and 50. We've done these other things. I'd be more than happy to have a different system where we didn't have lottery. But all I would ask people is this time, unlike Measure 5, pass the replacement revenue first. Mm-hmm. Don't get rid of the lottery revenue and then say, we'll just find some way to make it up, because I'm not encouraged over what I've seen over the last three decades that we'll do that.
Well, you and I will have a discussion about this as we go on.
I'd be glad to. I'd love to.
Representative Kenny Geyer, you're welcome. Thank you. Did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Thank you. It was following up on a question that you had asked in your email, and I wonder if you could just tell us what the loss would be in revenue for us, for schools, et cetera, if you went to the new proposal, if everything else stayed the same. Have you done that comparison?
Yeah, and basically it's what I said. It's 5.6 million is the amount that would drop in our revenue.
Drop in revenue, okay. Now, if everything stayed the same.
Yeah, so if we apply the new, and we're talking about new rates as if this was an actual proposal. This is the one that is the most generous to the retailers that we're looking at seriously. We won't necessarily go there. But if we went there, it would reduce, and we'd had no offsetting advantage in terms of further growth. If you just do a static analysis on where we are, it's $5.6 million, which, again, I say that's a lot of money. But it's It's 1.25% of our transfer, and we think we could, as I say, manage that out of our contingent reserve over the 5-year life of the contract without. So these services aren't going to miss anything.
The contingent reserve was $13 million or so.
It's $93 million.
Oh, $93 million. Okay.
And we added about $18 million just last. Now last year was unusual. We had provided for some contingencies that didn't come to pass, and we're trying to build it up also because as we go through this modernization plan, there are things that can go wrong. So we're not in no way would we look at depleting our reserves, but we don't have to at the kind of money we're talking about here. And I'm confident from the retailers we're talking to, there will be some growth from people who are changing their business practices. And we're not talking about aggressive advertising or getting into new games. Just by simply them being more energized and more forward-looking, I think we'd make it up. That's what I have to convince our commission that would be good, and that they have to decide that they want to do that. That's going to be their call. But
thank you so much, Jack. Appreciate you coming. Obviously, we need a much longer hearing, which we're not able to do today, but hopefully that will happen in the future. Thank you again so much.
Don't be a stranger with us.
I will not.
We hope your interest, and we'd love to continue to hear from you.
You stop at Daddy's all the time, too.
A couple times a day. Thank you. Thank you so much. And so now we're going to hear from Representative Sarah Gelser, and I see Amy Baker is here. Amy, come on right up here, and we want to hear about youth suicide. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, for putting this on the agenda. You all may recall in the February session we passed House Bill 4124, which created in the Department of in the Oregon Health Authority a new position, a youth suicide intervention coordinator, to work alongside the youth suicide prevention coordinator in public health. I understand that person started this week on December 1st, so looking forward to hear more about that. Amy is going to present a preliminary report about the work that's taken place since the bill went into effect. And there were a couple of things that I wanted to point out just from skimming the data. I actually had the opportunity to look at this report with my teenage daughter. I think we talked about this before. The community I live in right now is a youth suicide cluster, and our family has been directly touched by that tragedy, knowing several kids that we've lost, as do many kids in the community. So that's certainly an interest to kids in our community. But one of the things that really popped out to me, and one of the purposes of having this report, was to be able to see those gaps between need and intervention and service. And the thing that popped out at me first, and also at my daughter, frankly, was that of the 74 deaths in 2012 to suicide, only 19 of those kids were currently receiving treatment for a mental health problem. Even though 27 of them had a diagnosed mental health disorder, 9 had a problem with alcohol, 13 a problem with another substance, and 21 a current depressed mood. And that 19 current treatment includes mental health and substance abuse. And if you skim down in that, it also shows that 28 had disclosed that they planned to take their own life, and yet only 19 were able to access services. And that's certainly the story that we continue to hear in our community, is that families, school personnel are identifying kids that are at risk, not just at risk, but saying, I plan to take my own life, and the wait to access any type of service, regardless of payer source, whether it's Oregon Health Plan or private pay, insurance pay, could be 6 months to be able to access that. And then the other question that I had, just to tee up before you go through this, the number of hospitalizations due to self-inflicted injury, I'm wondering if we defined that the right way, because the number here is pretty low, and I'm wondering if those are admissions only rather than those that go to the emergency room, because a number of kids end up going to the emergency room and they are sent home with like a tranquilizer pill telling them to get some sleep, but they aren't admitted, which is really terrifying to parents and frustrating for law enforcement, who often has taken kids down there. But I know we had more than 7 in 2012 in Benton County, so I'm just wondering if we can figure out how to get that number maybe closer to what it is that we're looking for. But thank you.
And Amy, you've heard me say we're speed dating today because we have such a long agenda. So do you think you can sort of summarize this in maybe 5 minutes? Would that work?
I'll do my best.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Amy Baker, and I'm the Child and Family Manager with the Addictions and Mental Health Division. And I'm here to report on our progress year-to-date with House Bill 4124. And I actually would like to acknowledge Representative Gelser's effort in this and your acknowledgement that we can and should do better by our young people. So I appreciate that. And then, of course, spirit of Christmas past, Chair Tomei. Boy, we're sure going to miss you. So basically, the data that we reported is really lines up with what we're seeing nationally. What's happening in Oregon is not unique to Oregon. That within the report, about 70% of the youth suicide victims had a diagnosed mental health substance abuse disorder at the time of death. Like you said, about a third of them were under treatment. And this is the piece that's a little bit scary for me in terms of designing an intervention system. About 50% of them had some sort of a crisis prior to killing themselves, which means that there's some impulsivity behind the decision to kill oneself. And about a third of the adolescents who died by suicide had disclosed their intent to die. But again, that means two-thirds did not. I think youth suicide is really difficult to prevent because the act is impulsive and there's a lot of stigma attached to reaching out and acknowledging when it is that you need to get help. And I think the way that we think about mental health is really, I think, is going to have to shift if we ever get ahead of this problem. And I know I'm speed dating, but I have to tell you about the Great Smoky Mountain Study really, really quick because I think it really illustrates what we're up against. There was this longitudinal study that was done in 1993 in North Carolina, and they looked at kids from the ages from 9 to 21. And they evaluated these kids on 9 different occasions over the course of that period by doing a psychiatric assessment. And they were looking for psychiatric prevalence. And what they found was that by the time the kids turned 21, 61% of them had a well-defined psychiatric diagnosis. Another 20% had what we call as not otherwise specified diagnosis, which means you've got symptoms and we know something's wrong, but we're not really sure what it is. So that's a prevalence rate of like 83%. So what that says to me is that this isn't something that happens to some kids. This is something that happens to most kids in the course of their life, according to this study. And if that's true, then we have to think a lot more about not doing specialty mental health services necessarily, but promoting and protecting the mental health of all kids. So that's my plea around the whole prevention piece. And I think the idea of bringing addictions and mental health and public health together is brilliant because they've got the population health perspective and we've got the system design. And we need both of those in order to address this problem. So So here's where we're at so far in terms of the House Bill 4124. We've hired our suicide intervention coordinator. Her name is Ann Kirkwood. We stole her from Idaho. She's got 20 years of experience in suicide prevention. She helped start their crisis hotline there. She's a very successful grant writer. We're thrilled to have her. We've started working with public health around what our planning process is going to be. Obviously, we're using most of their data collection methods in order to gather the data. And to answer your question about the 508, those are kids who are hospitalized only. I don't think their ED data is. I've struggled to get good ED data just in part because of how.
ED.
Thank you. Emergency department. So the emergency room. In terms of how kids get diagnosed, it's not as comprehensive as when they're actually hospitalized. The other thing that's happened since House Bill 4124 was passed is we received a SAMHSA grant for about $736,000 a year for 5 years, and that is targeting 8 specific counties that were kind of determined to be high risk counties based on their youth suicide data. And the plan is to do everything that you would think that we would need to do, which is training people to identify youth, training clinicians to be able to talk about suicide with young people. You would think that we would all know that inherently, but that is actually a training need. It's also addressing access issues, meaning that we're able to get kids in for help when it is that they need to get in for help. And so we're hopeful that through that SAMHSA grant with those eight counties, we're going to become much smarter around how to design a system statewide.
Time's running out, Amy.
Huh?
Time's running out.
All right. So I'm just going to talk about the potential areas of challenge and talk about all the and not talk about all the great things we have done so far. And so basically what Representative Gelser had said is absolutely right. One of the biggest challenges we have is that the kids' mental health system is very insurance driven. And we have a lot of different payers, including private insurance. And there's a transition that needs to happen between the place where we are now, that people seek out help and treatment gets authorized, versus placing treatment that all kids can access regardless of payer, because trying to sort out who your insurance will pay for and won't pay for in the midst of a crisis is difficult. I also think our partnership with the schools is incredibly important for multiple reasons. That's where kids are. It's also where a lot of bullying happens, which is a risk factor. And there's 225 middle schools and 235 high schools in the state of Oregon. So figuring out how to connect resources with every single one of those schools is a challenge, especially because they all have their own culture, their own community. It's sort of dependent on the principal and the administration of that school. And so the work that we do there will have to be strategically crafted to that community. It makes it harder to do a universal strategy. So
you've got to sum it up, Amy.
Okay. I can also say that one of the things that I'm actually really excited about, and this is one of the legislative investments, is for the young adult peer advocacy. We have a contract with Youth Move Oregon. And Youth Move is basically an organization run by a bunch of young people. So they get how young people think. And they are have developed social media ways to reach out to kids who are struggling, and developing ways to text supportiveness. Those kinds of things that may be more effective in reaching young people who are having a hard time than expecting them to go to a mental health center.
That will be more time provided in February and through June of next year, because I think this is such important material, and I'm sorry we're having to cut you short. But I'm still stuck back on that 83% of kids who have mental health issues. And my feeling is high school is way too late. Yeah. Middle school is probably pretty late. It looks to me like we're looking at elementary school. And when we talked about prevention of gambling addiction, aren't we talking about prevention of mental health issues, and especially the extremes of suicide? So I'm hoping, and I know our good friends here will follow up on this and make sure that we're providing from looking at it from a prevention aspect and not just a treatment. So great. Thanks so much, Amy. Thank you, Representative Gelson.
It also strikes me that when we put OHA together, we had hoped we'd have these things in one place, and here we have something that goes across public health, mental health and addiction, and Medicaid. And I wonder whether it's getting the proper highlight in the authority, although you're sort of leaderless at the moment. But are there silos within OHA that are making this hard to deal with? And if so, we need to be looking at that in the next session. You don't need to comment on
that. We're going to depend on you, Representative. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Amy. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Sarah. Representative Gelser. Thanks so much. Okay, we're moving on to Domestic Violence Fatality Report, which is a terrible title. And do you think you can do this in 15 minutes? We're running a little late.
We'll do whatever you need us to do.
I like hearing that. Thanks. There are four of you. Okay. Do what you can. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Erin Greenewald. I'm an attorney with the Department of Justice. Specifically, I'm the Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor for the Oregon Department of Justice. And in that capacity, I have the distinct honor of co-chairing along with Lois Day, the statewide fatality review team. We're here today to report to you, as we are statutorily required, on our biennial report regarding the team's work. Before I sort of jump into the summary, though, I do want to take just a moment and read a few names to you. I think it's important. Monica Van Laer, Nicolette Elias, Cynthia Phillips, Elaine Wooden, Donna Perry, Rebecca Johnson, and Tanya Davis. These seven women were killed in domestic violence-related incidents in our state in November of 2014 alone. For the second year in a row, November has turned out to be a very deadly month in Oregon. In November of 2014, there were seven fatal domestic violence incidents that occurred in five different Oregon counties, some of which you all represent. There were nine deaths in total, including two perpetrators. Two other perpetrators tried to kill themselves but were unsuccessful. At least three of these incidents happened in front of children or where children were present. In fact, one of the perpetrators is currently charged with trying to murder his minor child. And at least five of these incidents involve the use of a firearm. In 2013, there were 31 domestic violence-related deaths in Oregon that occurred in 24 separate incidents. And again, each of you sitting here today represents a jurisdiction where a domestic violence-related incident occurred in 2013. Domestic and sexual violence, let alone the deaths related to those atrocities, happens far too often in our state and in our country. The report that I hope that you all have received both electronically and in hard copy form sets forth some of those more startling statistics, and I just want to capture a couple of those. Approximately one in five homicides in Oregon is related to domestic violence or intimate partner violence. 75% of all homicide-suicide incidents is related to intimate partner violence, and 87% of those is as a result of firearms. In domestic violence homicides, on average, 60 to 65% is as a result of firearm use. If a woman dies in Oregon or around the country in a domestic violence incident, she's probably died at the end of a gun barrel. The Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team has been tasked by statute to meet semi-annually and review domestic violence cases with the goal of improving the coordinated statewide response to and prevention of domestic violence and domestic violence fatalities. Just briefly in terms of the history, we began meeting regularly in 2011. We began our reviews in spring of 2012. We have reviewed four cases so far. Due to the exhaustive nature of our reviews, and what I mean by that is we don't simply just look at the incident. We look at the parties involved from their birth to their death or their incarceration. Because of the exhaustive nature of our review, we only do two cases per year. However, in the limited time that we've had and the few number of cases that we've reviewed, we've already been able to identify themes, trends, and areas for coordinated improvement. We brought forth our first report to you about our first review in 2012 at this same meeting. And you can find those recommendations and observations on page 5 of your report. Today and in the following months, we will offer to you observations and recommendations about the other cases that we've reviewed. On page 6, in the middle of the page, the report sets forth the key findings of the most recent case reviews, excluding the one that we did just last week. We'll begin in February of 2015 submitting installments or mini reports on these key areas. But to summarize, those areas are addressing the significant and severe impact on children who are exposed to domestic violence, improving the safety provided by our civil protection orders, addressing diverse points of intervention, and improving community awareness and cultural change. All of these have in common that they have an eye towards improving and increasing our ability to prevent domestic violence and its related deaths. One area I just want to also comment on is that along with completing case reviews and developing and implementing recommendations and working with the Governor's Domestic Violence Council to implement those recommendations, one of the things that we also do as a fatality review team and that we are obligated by statute to do is to assist local domestic violence fatality review teams, either in the implementation of their recommendations or in the creation of new local fatality review teams, which is important. All of these very important obligations, however, are difficult to achieve given that this team is not funded in any meaningful or permanent way. It's a multi-jurisdictional, multidisciplinary, all-volunteer team comprised of individuals who, while dedicated to the missions and values of the team, have other full-time jobs and obligations and demands on their time. I guess I'll close by saying this, that among other things, domestic violence is a public safety issue. It certainly is a public health crisis. What it is not is a private issue. As you have heard, there are names and faces and children and friends and communities attached to each person who has lost his or her life due to domestic violence. I want to thank each of you, and especially you, Madam Chair, for your work on these issues. I hope to see each of you at the celebration to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the passing of the Violence Against Women Act, which will take place at noon at the Galleria of the State Capitol. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Any quick questions? Thank you so much. Hi, Lois.
Good morning. For the record, my name's Lois Day. I'm the Director for Child Welfare at the Department of Human Services, and I'm just going to briefly give you some of the impacts that we see at DHS and then pass it on to our law enforcement partner. As Aaron stated, domestic violence is a significant safety issue for children, and it's a significant trauma experience for children, and it goes well beyond the violence they witness. It's the whole dynamic that exists in homes where domestic violence is occurring that increases the trauma that children experience living in these homes. In 2013, in child welfare, domestic violence was a recorded stressor in 32% of our child victims. That represents 3,380 children. In October of 2014, it was almost 35%, which was 389 child victims. Domestic violence can also result in a founded allegation, exposure to domestic violence. It's in our threat of harm category. And in 2013, 44% of the threat of harm, represented 44% of our founded allegations of abuse. And within that category, 53% of those were for witnessing domestic violence. So it's a very significant issue for us in child welfare. In our self-sufficiency program, in October of 2014, there were 1,889 identified domestic violence cases that came in. There's a program in our self-sufficiency program where you can access a monetary support for emergent safety and stability if you have children and it's needed for the victims. And 27% of the identified domestic violence cases received that monetary support. All the cases that are identified have access to the referrals and some housing options related to domestic violence, but not everyone qualifies for the extra monetary support. We have some services available that cross over our two programs. We have co-housed advocates in all but one county, Union County. We don't have co-housed advocates there. We have 32 full FTE, which actually represents 51 advocates in our offices that are accessible to child welfare and self-sufficiency workers in the moment when someone comes in, which is an extremely helpful service for victims to help them navigate and actually help them create safety for themselves and their children while they figure out how they're going to move forward. Unfortunately, 51 advocates means some are part-time and some cover multiple counties, and so the access isn't as available as co-housing might suggest, and it's a needed service that our workers rely on heavily. We also train staff in the dynamics of domestic violence, recognizing domestic violence, and our child welfare staff receive specialized training that helps increase their skills in working with the whole family, which we're required to do. So that's just some of our numbers, and really appreciate your all's support for this work, and we'll miss you, Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I'll miss you too, Lois. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Tomei. Committee members, Deputy Chief Steve Belshaw of the Salem Police Department. Part of why I was drawn to this committee is because of the opportunity to help make our community safer, which is something I have been committed to for my over 25-year career. And as we've looked at these fatalities across the state, we've seen success and we've seen failures. And where we've seen success is in the communities that see this as more than just a law enforcement problem, but this is a community problem and has taken that team approach. Those are teams that have well-trained officers that are trained in domestic violence, in responding to domestic violence calls, and holding offenders accountable early and often for their bad behavior. Team members that have advocates that are responsive and are trained to go out and quickly respond and provide services to our advocates, and who have shelters that give our victims a safe place to stay immediately so they can assess where they are in life and what their next safe step is. Prosecutors who will aggressively prosecute these cases and hold offenders accountable and say, no, not in our community. It's not okay to react with violence. And then supervising parole and probation officers that will specialize in domestic violence offenders and realize that these are manipulative offenders that are controlling and, again, hold these people accountable and not let them go back into the lives of those victims. And then, again, part of that team is legislative support. We have given great support from the legislature over the past years. You've given us felony domestic violence ability to do that. You've given us the ability to prosecute strangulation cases and those things. And those have, again, helped us hold offenders accountable much more effectively. But there's still more to do. In upcoming sessions, you're going to have to wrestle with some tough ideas. Some things like being able for law enforcement to issue protective orders out in the field, similar to stalking orders, to get victims safety very quickly and in a more expedient manner. You're going to have to wrestle with the issue of how do we legally and lawfully get restrict access to firearms for these DV offenders, because that is the weapon of choice and continues to be the weapon of choice that is killing our victims. The resources that are out there, when I arrest these offenders and we hold them accountable, the victims have to have resources to start over and to deal with those things safely. And early warning systems. And again, you know, the things that we want to do are prevent. If we could prevent these things, my wish is that you could put me out of a job, that we could do prevention early on and teach kids to solve problems without violence, and that's not okay. And as I talk to law enforcement across the state and across the country, I hear, you know, there are other priorities. What about drug offenders? What about other things? And you can't ignore domestic violence. If you look at the majority, the studies show us over and over again, the majority of our drug dealers, our violent offenders, start in domestic violence homes, not learning how to solve problems well. So we can't, if we're serious about reducing crime, we have to start by addressing domestic violence.
Thank you, and thank you for that message. Sybil, it's good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here. I'm also a member of the Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team. I echo the comments and support the comments that my co-panelists have made, and I really appreciate the attention and time that this committee has given and your leadership, Chair Tomei. I wanted to draw the committee's attention to a few issues that will be coming forward for discussion in the coming session that I think provide an opportunity to make some progress here. I think what we're all saying is that we need to get our arms around this issue, and by doing that, we need to make sure that there is every door possible is open to a survivor or to a victim when she comes forward seeking help. We need to make sure that there are informed resources there that can help link a survivor to all of the safety services that are available in the community. And so many of our victims don't have an awareness of where those resources are or where to go for help. So going back to the co-housed advocates that Lois talked about, having domestic violence advocates at the child welfare offices, which is a program that came forward out of the work that this committee did a number of years ago, having that program fully staffed and operational in a way that can meet the capacity across the state makes all of the difference in the world, because so many of those survivors coming into the child welfare system or into the self-sufficiency offices have never before had contact with any domestic violence advocacy programs. They were unaware that they were available. They may not have identified that they themselves were victims. It's very difficult for people to understand and acknowledge that. Without that expert help and getting people connected to those safety systems, we're not able to really adequately resolve that self-sufficiency case or that child welfare case. So we're hoping to expand the resources that that program has to offer for survivors throughout the state to make sure it's fully available. I also wanted to draw your attention to the issue of housing, which is, of course, one of the subject areas that this committee focuses on. And the lack of access to affordable housing and to shelter has a huge impact on victims of domestic violence, and it is shown nationally, and we see it here anecdotally in the stories that we hear. So many people don't physically have a place to go that they can afford. They can spend the night safely and with their children. And if they don't have that place to go, they're staying at home in unsafe situations. And that's a driver for the cases coming into the child welfare system. It's a driver to the cases going into the emergency room and into the prosecutor's offices. So if we can focus resources and development on housing and making sure that it's accessible and safe for survivors, and also on the resources, the expert advocacy resources in our child welfare and self-sufficiency offices, I think we'll make a big difference in how we see people moving towards safety. So I really thank you all for your attention and leadership.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos, you had a question?
Yes, a question. I want more of a comment. I think, first of all, I want to thank you all for your presentation. I want to thank Chair Tomei for her leadership. And I just want to assure you that even though she won't be here, her spirit will still guide us in our work. But, you know, seriously, I Rachel, you were there yesterday with the Higher Ed Committee where we looked at rape on campuses and so on. And part of the comment there was that, you know, we're really talking about violence against women. And I really hope we can take that list that you gave us and put forth some legislation this next session to really deal with this head on. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any quick questions, Representative?
I wanted to thank you for a great presentation. This is tremendous, and you did a tremendous job presenting this important issue, which too often we don't talk about. But I think this year in particular, there's a real surge in momentum, and I think it's true in the state legislature to pass some laws that will really make a difference, even though it won't be 100% easier, the course of least resistance. And so I hope that you will take encouragement from the fact that we're going to be championing this issue alongside you, and we have great respect for the leadership you've given our community. Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much. Great presentation. Good work. So now we've got Representative Reardon and Parrish, Janet Bird, and Omar Carrillo Tiuniero. Am I pronouncing that correct? Affordability Balanced Choice Housing Work Group. And if you can do this in 15 minutes, I would be so grateful. We're running a little behind. Okay, start up.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning, Chair Tomei, committee members. Very delighted to be here. I'm Representative Jeff Reardon. I was chair of the Affordability, Balance, and Choice Housing Work Group, and basically two takeaways, and then I will read my letter that's in your packet. Two takeaways is we have a huge, huge housing issue in Oregon. It is much greater than I'd ever anticipated before getting into this work. And we're going to make some good steps with the legislation that we'll talk about this morning. But and the governor is kicking in some money in his budget or proposing that. But we have so much work to do. It's really on a scale of probably our transportation challenges, our education challenges. So I'll stop there, read the letter, and Dear Chair
no.
Tomei, thank you for the opportunity to speak today to the House Committee on Housing and Human Services about the work completed by the Affordability, Balance, and Choice Housing Work Group. I'm very proud of the work this group completed, which resulted from meaningful conversations amongst housing advocates, developers, and financiers from across the state. This group arose from a bill I submitted in 2013 to repeal Oregon's ban on inclusionary zoning. As you know, that bill did not become law, but the Speaker offered her support in convening a group to discuss housing issues that affect our entire state, including inclusionary zoning. Over the course of the last 10 months, the group discussed dozens of ideas and ended with an extensive list of policy proposals. I was so pleased to see that, despite the differing views held by group members, we were able to identify a number of policy recommendations with unanimous support that will increase the availability of affordable housing for many Oregonians. We used, and it's important to dwell on this, we used a unanimous voting model to identify ideas likely to have broad support among legislators so as to build momentum for coalition's work. When we discussed the issue of inclusionary zoning, the original impetus for the work group, there was indeed significant support among the group. However, the entire group did not reach consensus on the issue of repealing the ban. The issue of inclusionary zoning remains on the long list of policy ideas aimed at helping Oregonians to rent, purchase, or stay in their homes. I encourage work group members to continue developing these policy ideas for future sessions. Furthermore, I hope this process helped them to identify new allies so that they may work more effectively on issues most important to their respective organizations. The housing crisis in Oregon is a complex and widespread issue. I do not believe that our initial offering of our policy proposals will fix every problem, but I think we have made a very good start, and I look forward to using the work of the Affordability, Balance, and Choice Housing Work Group to continue advocating for better housing options for all Oregonians. And before I forget, Chair Tomei, it's been wonderful working with you for the last 2 years, and I'm so happy to see that you're going on to the next phase of your life.
Thank you. I've enjoyed working with you, too.
I can't help but jump in on that. We're glad you're leaving, too.
I knew that was coming. I just didn't know who it would come from.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, Representative Julie Parrish, House District 37, and I don't have a letter prepared. I usually just kind of speak from the heart. Couple things. First, I have to say, you know, there's something about this process where we can go out and, you know, beat each other up in campaigns, and on November 5th, we dust ourselves off and we come back to the building and we get the work done. And, you know, Jeff and I are kind of an unlikely pairing on this issue, and yet I was really glad that he asked when he came back and the Speaker gave him permission to do a work group. And I also have to say, I like a work group over a task force, and the reason being is that, you know, a task force, we come in and we have a mandate that says you'll address these things, and it feels very set in stone that we have to accomplish what's in that. And I'm on a task force right now where it's like, you know, here's the prescribed stuff we have to work on, and sometimes that puts you in a box where this work group model, we didn't have a legislative directive, and I think that really opened up our process to be able to push the boundaries of people who are all over the map on how we can get to affordable housing. And from that, you know, there were over 40 different things besides the inclusionary zoning issue that we addressed as problems, and they really ranged from anything from some land use issues, some not in my backyard type stuff, local zoning issues at the city that frankly we may or may not be able to affect, but we can certainly look at how do we incentivize cities to have better policies. And so, you know, the bills that you're getting from us, that Janet, and I have to say Janet Byrd has been fantastic as kind of our leader on this. And so, you know, she's going to explain the bills in depth. But I really think it's important to know that we came up with at least 25 things where when we talk about that unanimous voting model, that everybody said we can get our hands around that. And we're only bringing you five kind of proposals. We could probably spend the next
4 or 5 years in legislative sessions working just through the unanimous consent items that we all came up with before we ever started working into any of the things where there was some discrepancy on either side where people said, you know, we're not quite interested in this or this isn't a priority for the organization that we represent. So there's a lot of work to be done. And I know that there'll also be, you know, a bill brought forward on inclusionary zoning again. And I really want to just caution that that we take the consensus items and not muddy those waters because the work I think we did is really valuable. And I think there's still a lot more work to be done. And, you know, Jeff and I have committed to the group that we will continue to meet during the session with this group, you know, at least once a month as we go through the process. I am committed to working on this group past the session ending and past whatever bills we got done, because I really do believe that affordable housing is probably one of the most critical issues we can take and tackle in the human service realm. If you do not have a stable home over your head, you also don't have a stable meal coming in. You don't have the ability to, you know, think about having stability in your job. And as somebody who has personally experienced long periods off and on growing up and even into adulthood with homelessness, I think housing is one of the most base things that we can try to solve in the legislature. Some of the proposals that, you know, we're going to bring forward don't have a financial request. I think we need to work through those policies as quickly as we can. Some of them do have a money request, and we know that money is going to be tight this year, and we know that the governor has carved off one type of mechanism for housing, but I think we need to look at some of the other ones that we are proposing. Again, I just really go back to, if we don't have safe, stable, affordable housing for people, it's a problem. I had a constituent call me because a gentleman in our neighborhood, you know, a builder was taking down that home and was going to put in some new housing. He was renting that home. This just happened this week. And, you know, the gentleman, single dad, he's got two kids. Westland is not the most affordable place to live. And, you know, the question was, is, well, where can he go to keep his child in school? That's why some of the education policies around choice, I think, kind of go in tandem with some of these things. Sometimes people get, you know, put out of their school district because of the housing issues. And I certainly experienced that going to 5 elementary schools as a child. So, you know, these issues, the housing issues, I also want to caution the committee, are not in a bubble by themselves. When you're thinking about housing, it's not just enough to say, well, we're going to build affordable housing in this part of the city and, you know, lump people over here where there's no transportation, no access to jobs, there's food deserts, and, you know, and they're maybe in the poorest performing schools. So we have a lot of work to do around this, and I want us to, you know, proceed with caution. I want us to also take the recommendations that are consensus and really drive forward, not just the ones that we're doing this year, but also be able to come back in the next, in the short session, maybe pull a couple of those other items off and continue to work down that list and have this group in some way, shape, or form, whether it's Jeff and I or other legislators who get involved with it, continue to do the work, because the list is long and extensive. And again, some of the policy stuff, that's free. We can make those decisions without an impact to the state budget and start to see some changes in this housing market. So I really do appreciate everybody and the diversity in the group and the commitment. You know, none of our volunteers were paid. Some of them came from long ways away and traveled from across the state. So this really was urban and rural, and you know, looking at housing as the need fits the geography of the state and the commitment from those who came and put the work in. And again, particularly you know, Janet and John Chandler was in that mix as well, leading the direction from kind of both sides of the mm-hmm. conversation. And I think you'll really appreciate the work product. So thank you. And
thank
Chair
you,
Tomei, I was, you know, pleased to serve with you on this committee. And I will say it's a shame to see you go instead of glad to see you go.
Thank you, Representative. Janet, it's good to see you.
Thank you. You Omar's going to kick
okay.
off.
Okay, sure.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Omar Carayotina-Hero, for the record. I want to underscore a few points that the representatives made. The work group's diversity included people from the nonprofit, for-profit, developer world, real estate, local jurisdictions, service providers, and many others who were really ready to find solutions to this complex problem that's affecting communities all across the state. As you have heard, the work group's ambitious charge set out a broad scope aimed not only at affordable but also inclusive communities, and with the recognition that meeting our education, our health goals, our planning goals all start with having homes. to wake up in and return to at night. The work group looked closely at housing need across the state and benefited from presentations from many local leaders. It's clear that we're falling short in many ways all across the state. For example, in the Central Gorge, there's a need for housing to match employment growth. We heard from our partners in Bend and Central Oregon that there's a critical shortage of housing at all price levels, leading to a vacancy rate that's well below 1%. In Eugene, the combination of low median incomes and high housing costs and high demands has increased homelessness and rental unaffordability. And as you've heard in Portland, development at the high end of the rental market is causing neighborhoods to change character and is displacing existing residents. It's also pushing lower income residents out into economically and racially segregated communities, which often lack basic infrastructures to support those residents. We learned that we are not, as a state or as local communities, meeting our obligations to affirmatively further fair housing or to effectively counteract trends towards economic and racial segregation. To address this, we looked at a broad range of tools, as the representatives mentioned, including financing tools, policy and land use tools, and other development strategies, which I'll...
You weren't here at the beginning, but I said this is sort of speed dating.
Yeah.
We are not able to go into great depth on any of the issues because we have so many issues we're dealing with today. So can you come up with your recommendations?
I will kick it over to Janet, who will talk about our recommendations.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships and had the honor of working on this work group. And we do know that you're under a time limit. So the last page of the report that you have on OLIS and that was distributed to you outlines the recommendations that the work group is moving forward in 2015. All of these will come to your committee in depth once they're introduced, and so I won't spend a lot of time with them. We basically, as Omar indicated, we came up with a way to kind of characterize both the need and solutions into four categories. So the first is money, and we don't really have a recommendation around money per se. The governor's budget gives us a great opportunity to talk about that because he did talk about a way to put equity or cash into affordable housing development. We look forward to having that conversation. The other three categories are debt or, you know, cheap credit, cheap finance. That was a theme that came up kind of throughout. And we have two solutions for that. One would be a referral to the voters of a constitutional amendment that would free up Housing and Community Services' ability to issue general obligation bonds that would act like revenue bonds. So it's again, I look forward to the opportunity to sort of go into all the wonky details with you. I won't do that today. But it's a way to sort of free up the credit market. We heard, particularly outside the Portland metro area, credit is just still not available for housing development. It's a huge barrier. The other sort of credit mechanism or debt mechanism would be an expansion on the cap on the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, which is a tax credit mechanism that we have in place. Currently has a cap of $17 million. We have a placeholder bill that's also on OLIS that asks for an expansion to $40 million. We know that we're not going to ask for that much. There's a work group meeting now separately convened by Housing and Community Services that's going to come up with a full report and a recommendation about the expansion of that tool, but that's a debt tool. The other issue that we heard quite a bit about is land availability and access to land. So we have two concepts that we're going to be supporting. One is there's a statewide coalition that's been working to look at reclamation of brownfields, and we will be supporting particularly the parts of that coalition's work that deal with reclaiming brownfields for land banking. We heard a lot over the course of the year of the work group about the effectiveness of land banking in getting at some of the location issues that are essential in, and Omar referenced this. You know, it's not just affordability and cost, and Representative Parrish did as well. We need to think about the location of housing that we're supporting the creation of, and land banking is a great tool for that. Along those lines, we are submitting a bill asking for an inventory of ODOT Scott owned lands, and we'll be amending the draft that's in OLIS to include Department of State lands as well. We need to look again at what other state resources we have that we could dedicate to addressing the issue of housing, which you've heard is such a need. And then finally, we looked a lot at policy tools, and we looked a lot at kind of the balance of what local jurisdictions are required to do, capable of doing, given their limited budgets, and how that plays in with the land use system in Oregon. And one of the things that we came up with that we really want to see addressed this year is kind of a disconnect within the Department of Housing and Community Services and Department of Land Conservation and Development. Jurisdictions are supposed to be looking at their ability to meet the needs for housing across all income levels. They're not really empowered to do that. They don't have the tools or the resources to do that. We think Housing and Community Services should be taking a really close look at that system and looking closely to see that local jurisdictions have what they need to meet their obligations under both state land use laws and federal requirements to affirmatively further fair housing. We'll also be monitoring. We heard a lot about the issue of NIMBYism, or not in my backyard, being a huge barrier to affordable housing development. We've seen some really pretty awful examples of that, particularly in Southern Oregon. And so we'll be monitoring discussions around adjustments to land use law that would help facilitate development and counteract NIMBYism. So again, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. We look forward to really in-depth conversation on behalf of the work group. We will be continuing, as Representative Parrish said, to monitor this and to meet together throughout the legislative session.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any sure. questions?
Yeah.
Yes, Representative
Parrish. Again, I just want to make another comment about how much I appreciate the work of the committee or the work group. And frankly, on behalf of the committee, I think I also say that really appreciate the evolution of the discussion with regard to housing and how important it is in terms of mental health, in terms of safety, in terms of education. I think it's really an important piece for us to make sure that we have on the table. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. Thanks for all your work. And I know sometimes it's hard to keep that up, those meetings through the year, but good for doing that. Good for you. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
So next we have the early learning system update. I think I saw Pam coming in. Great. So you didn't hear my comment earlier. We're doing speed dating. Well, you really are into the speed dating here. I can see that. Because we have a very full agenda. So we're happy to see you, and we're really anxious to know what's happening.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting us to speak with you today. For two of you, this will be a little bit of a repeat from yesterday's House Education Committee, so hang in there with us. For the record, my name is Megan Irwin, and I'm the Acting Early Learning System Director, which means I run the Early Learning Division as part of the Department of Education, and I staff the Early Learning Council. We were invited today to come give you an update on our early learning system work, and so Pam Curtis will give an overview of the overall gestalt of what we've been doing the last 2 years and go into some of our work around stable families. And then I'll talk about our connection to K-12 and our overall system coordination work.
Thank you.
Great. Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Pam Curtis. I am the director of the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at Oregon Health and Science University, and I have the pleasure of chairing, with my volunteer hat on, the state's Early Learning Council. And probably most importantly today, I'm a constituent of Representative Tomei. So thank you for your support over the years, and it's been a pleasure to live in your district.
Thank you.
So as Megan mentioned, I want to give a little bit of context for the work of the Early Learning Council, and then I will provide a bit of an update and then hand it over to Megan to provide you an update on a couple of other areas. So as a reminder, Oregon has established, thanks to you and the work of your colleagues, what we know as 40-40-20, or our education goals, summarized as by 2020, 40% of our adults will at least have a bachelor's degree, 40% will have an associate's or a post-secondary credential, and 20% will hold a high school diploma or the equivalent. We really see the early learning system as the foundation that builds, building the foundation so that those goals can actually be achieved. So just a word of a word about brain development and how early learning starts, or how learning really starts for children. We know that there's an abundance now of scientific evidence that clearly demonstrates the critical aspects of brain development, particularly those that are most associated with learning, happen before and immediately following birth. And in fact, the most fundamental aspects of that architecture are established a long time before a child enters school. Despite this growing information and the growing recognition of these facts, a majority of the processes that we've historically had in Oregon in terms of how learning is established happened after the age of six. And so that really formed some of the foundation of your thinking when you put the early learning system in place. So now just a word about our children in Oregon. We know that every year in Oregon about 45,000 kids are born, and if you're like me and you like babies, you think that's a very exciting thing and it's a good thing. The bad news is that, let me stop and say that that means in the 0 to 6 early brain development time frame, we have about 315,000 kids at any one point in time in that cohort under the age of six. The bad news is that no matter how you slice it, about 40% of those kids are exposed to significant risk factors that place them at risk for really fully being able to participate in school experience successfully once they enter school. Let me just give you a few examples. And these are all known well to you. We know that one in every four children lives in poverty. We know that at least half of the children in our state are born on Medicaid, and depending on which part of the state you live in, that could be significantly higher. We know that we are in the number 13 for foster care placement in the states, and we're in the bottom quartile for third grade reading. So it's a pretty significant and stark picture for our kids under the age of six. Now, in statute, you established three goals for our early learning system. One was kindergarten readiness. The second, and these are not in priority order, is ensuring that children are raised in stable families by caregivers to whom they are attached. And the third is that our early learning system is a coordinated and integrated system, not an accretion of separate efforts. So you establish those goals over 2 years and four separate pieces of legislation that began in 2011 when you created the Early Learning Council, which I chair along with 18 other volunteer citizens from Oregon. You, the following year, received a plan from the Early Learning Council and directed us to make improvements in our early learning services, including creating regional early learning hubs to coordinate services regionally and delegating oversight of the early learning system to the council. In 2013, you gave us some very specific direction for establishing hubs, and we'll talk about those in just a moment. And you established the Early Learning Division, again, just about a year ago, which Megan serves as the director. And so what we want to do now is give you a very high-level summary of the work we've been about in each of those three goal areas over the course of the last year or 18 months. Again, we're going to talk about stable families, including how we are connecting to our healthcare system, kindergarten readiness, including how we're connecting to K-12 and in particular K-3, and how we are coordinating our community system of supports, including the development of hubs. So first, stable families, and in particular, the connection to healthcare. So if you think about helping our kids, we know that before they enter our formal education system at kindergarten, they primarily show up in two places. The first place they primarily show up is in healthcare. We know that in Oregon, over 90% of our children have at least one experience, most of them multiple experiences with the healthcare system before they enter the school.
So we are very dedicated to working with our healthcare partners and joining forces so that we identify those children and families who need as extra support as early as possible in their lives, whether that be through a clinic or a visit with a nurse or a doctor. So we have established a joint committee along with the Oregon Health Policy Board, and we've been meeting for almost 2 years now to work on the intersection between early learning and healthcare. Our purpose was to look for common areas of alignment or integration between health transformation and our early learning system transformation efforts. An initial set of recommendations has been adopted by both of the policy bodies, and it includes the establishment of kindergarten readiness as a shared outcome for healthcare and for early learning. And we currently have a technical committee meeting to work on establishing joint metrics and incentives between these two systems. We also jointly staff the local transformation efforts between the two systems. We have established shared learning collaboratives between the local CCOs and the local early learning hubs. And we are in the process of putting in place a statewide system of screening with healthcare as the initial point of identification of risk, as I mentioned earlier. And now I'm going to turn it over to Megan to talk about our kindergarten readiness goal that you put in statute and also the coordination and integration.
And we've got 3 minutes.
Ooh. Okay.
Goodness. All right.
Thanks, Pam. So just as it's important to focus on connecting to healthcare and in early childhood, it's also incredibly important for us to focus on how we're connecting into the K-3 system and to have really intentional school readiness strategies. For us, one of the core school readiness strategies that we've been implementing for really about the last year and statewide for the last 6 months is a focus on improving the quality of regulated childcare through what we call the quality rating improvement system. And this is really important because only about 15,000 children are in our state-funded, our publicly funded preschool program. Most are in childcare. And there's a wide range of what happens in childcare. Some programs are focused on the basic health and safety of children, while others, whether they're in homes or in centers, are running what you would recognize as an early learning and development program or environment. So through
I'm just going to stop you for a minute because, you know, we've been dealing with this issue since before it began. So we sort of know the background.
Okay, great.
So what we'd like is an update, and I know people are interested in the hubs.
Yeah, okay, so, we'll move right to it. So on the QRIS, just so that you know, we have 190 programs now that are at the 3, 4, or 5 star level, and 778 programs that have attended at least an initial training. So we're encouraged by the participation that we've seen over the last 6 months since we've taken it statewide. If you're interested in the hubs, why don't we just jump right to that? So give me just 1 second to move forward there. So you have been dealing with the Early Learning Hub work since it began.
Yes.
I think you're familiar with their responsibilities. So just to give you an update on where we're at, while we've been very much in startup mode since August 2013, we currently have 14 Early Learning Hubs established across the state, with the last two on track for certification and contract by the end of the biennium. One thing that's been really interesting to watch as they've emerged are the types of organizations that have stepped forward to lead. We have 4 nonprofits, a large handful of education service districts, 6 ESDs who are leading the hubs. One is led by a county, one is led by a CCO, and one is led by a community college. And so it's been really interesting to watch communities step forward and organize themselves around concepts that they've been talking about at the community level for a long time in a really new way. While they have been focused on startup activities, building governance bodies, figuring out a strategic plan, it's also been interesting to watch the hubs who are the most mature start to really do substantive work in their communities. The area where I think they've gained the most traction is actually in that P3 connection piece, connecting early childhood to K-12. And I think that's because we've had some dedicated resource to put there. We've also seen some really interesting work start to emerge with the hubs and early literacy activities. One in particular, while you often think about early literacy as connecting to the formal school system, one hub is actually approaching early literacy through connecting to the healthcare system in a way that's really interesting, using a program called Reach Out and Read, where they've been able to actually reach 90% of the children in their coverage area who are on the Oregon Health Plan by partnering with only 10 health clinics, because those are the 10 clinics that those children actually go to. And so it's been interesting to watch as the hubs have gotten small amounts of investment this biennium, that they're starting to actually put it effectively to use in a way that I don't think that we could do from on high in Salem. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot to still learn as they're emerging, but it's been encouraging to watch them do their early work.
That's great. I think when we first heard about the hubs, it sounded aspirational. I used that from a previous hearing. Yeah. So it's interesting to hear how it has become operational. That's fantastic. I'm glad to hear that. So one of the issues that we heard early on, and I know Representative Wisnett, who usually sits over there, had this question about how does it work, because some hubs in the less populated areas, it wouldn't be one hub per county. It might cover several counties. So how is that working?
Do you want me to start? Sure. And you can add in. So I think that one of the things that was really smart about the way that the legislation was put together is that the legislature allowed flexibility in how hubs chose to govern mm-hmm. themselves. And so in some multi-county hubs, we're seeing kind of a core body that's making decisions as like an executive type committee with local satellite governing boards that are actually making the local decisions and feeding it up. And then we have others. One that comes to mind is the Frontier Hub, which is Grant and Harney counties, where despite challenges of vast empty geography, they've chosen to have one core governing group, and they meet in person, and they're just willing to make that commitment. There's been a fair amount of flexibility in how folks have chosen to do that.
That's wonderful. I'm glad it's worked out. We need to move on. Thank you so much, and I'm sure you'll be coming back to this committee.
I think we will.
2015. Thank you so much. Next, we have employment-related daycare. And if you could do that, how much time?
They were at 10 o'clock.
Great, thank you. And if can you do your presentation in 10 minutes? Is that perfect? Thank you.
Or less.
Or less.
Perfect.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rhonda Pradzinski. I'm the Child Care and Refugee Program Manager at Department of Human Services.
And my name is Kelly Walker from the Early Learning Division, Director of Child Care Licensing and Subsidy. Chair Tomei and members of the committee.
Thank you.
So we're here today to provide an update on the employment-related daycare program. ERDC is a critical work support that supports many low-income families. It provides safe, affordable, high-quality child care that supports child development and school readiness and helps reduce the achievement gap. We currently have over 8,500 families that are receiving child care assistance through the ERDC program. DHS provides payments to a variety of child care providers, including approved, licensed, and license-exempt providers. These providers are instrumental in providing care to many of our parents who have work constraints, such as fluctuating and non-standard work hours. Over 4,700 self-employed child care providers are caring for almost 16,000 children. About 764 of these, and those include certified family homes and also all of our child care centers. These also employ additional staff. We're seeing a trend for our subsidy families to use more licensed child care. There also has been a significant increase in the number of families transitioning from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF program, to ERDC. The average over the last 10 years has been 245 per month. But since the beginning of 2014, the average has increased to over 400 per month. More TANF families are finding work, and child care is crucial for them retaining these jobs. Continuity and stability of child care can improve children's education as well as adults' work stability. The ERDC program budget has not been able to support the 2013-15 average caseload of 8,500 cases, and this is due to increases in the cost per case. The cap was adjusted to 7,800, and the reservation list was activated on October 1st of 2014. We have over 900 families and over 1,600 children currently on the list.
On the waiting list?
On the waiting list.
Wow.
Right. And if you look, we provided an overview, and on the overview there are some exemptions so that families can get on. And I'll just quickly go through those. If they're transitioning from TANF, if they've received ERDC in the past two calendar months, a new exemption we've added, they've been determined eligible for temporary assistance for domestic violence survivor benefits in the current or preceding 3 months. They have eligibility for a contracted child care slot in a high quality program. And then also a newer exemption is a child welfare referral.
Can I ask a question? Exemption means you move up. It's exempt from what?
You're exempt from the reservation list.
That means you get a spot.
Yes, if you meet all the other eligibility requirements.
Even if it's over the 8,500?
No. You have to meet all the income eligibility requirements, but you just don't go onto the reservation list.
But if it's capped at 8,500 and you're exempt, will you go over 8,500 to provide spots for those categories?
Yes, but with attrition, we still plan on keeping within that 7,800 for rest of the biennium.
Attrition would be due to somebody losing their job. What else?
There's many reasons. They don't need child care any longer.
Okay.
Or they've gone over income.
Can I do a follow-up?
Yes.
Because I know there's some proposed changes about keeping on for a year. Right.
Yes.
Now, if they lose a job, do they end their child care at the end of that month?
They can have up to 2 months, depending on when they lose their job, but at least a month.
I have a question.
Yes.
What is the average amount per month that they get, and is it per child or per family?
So the child care, all of our families have a copay, and it will depend on their child care needs, so based on their income and family size and what kind of child care they choose.
What are we looking at in general? Give us some examples of how much, and is it per child or is it per family?
Right. So per family, it would be, our average cost per case is $670.
A month?
A month. We're going to be closely monitoring the caseload and expenditures to determine if we can pull names from a reservation list and if the reservation list can be deactivated. So we're keeping a very close eye on that. I wanted to also provide some updates on some other current priorities that we have. DHS has strengthened its health and safety requirements for subsidy providers. A mandatory pre-service health and safety training is now required for our exempt providers and registered family providers. Our exempt providers also attend a mandatory orientation.
Exempt meaning exempt from what?
From licensing.
Okay. So this would be a neighborhood daycare that might take in 2 or 3 or 4 children who doesn't have a license. But she would still have to take this training, right?
Correct.
And Kate Brown wrote a letter that I think that all of us received about these higher costs. So we might want to deal with that.
Right. And Chair Tomei, Kelly's going to talk about that in a little bit.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure.
So we've also, our home and facility standards were also increased to align with licensing standards. And then another thing I just wanted to mention was our work around service equity. We've been gathering data in order to identify gaps and disparities in the services we provide within our local communities. ERDC demographic data has been gathered for work with the early learning hubs. We're also collecting and analyzing data on the percentages of children in quality child care settings by race and ethnicity. The DHS quarterly benchmark review shows a breakdown by race and ethnicity of the ERDC caseload, and that's in comparison to the general population in Oregon. And we're developing strategies to improve any disparities. Last month, the President signed the Child Care and Development Block Grant Act of 2014 into law. And this law reauthorizes the child care program for the first time since 1996. And it represents an historic re-envisioning of the Child Care and Development Fund program. So now Kelly's going to provide an overview of that and possible impacts to the program.
Thank you, Rhonda.
I have another question, if I may. Does a family get the child care dollars if their children are enrolled in a pre-K or K program?
Not if there's already funding for the child.
So if they're in a pre-K, state-funded pre-K slot?
Right.
It would depend on if they're in that slot and then they also have additional child care outside of that. They may be eligible
that would be
for some.
Yeah.
So does it go by the hours that they're outside of an institutional setting that you give them money or what? How is it that this works when we're paying for a pre-K program and then we're paying for child care also?
Representative Wood said it would be for the wraparound, so the additional hours of care while the parent's working, that would be covered.
Okay.
Okay.
So, as Rhonda said, the Child Care and Development Block Grant Reauthorization is going to charge all states with some major changes in child care policy, and we've been working towards a plan for these changes for a while. And there's basically four component areas where we will be most affected. And the first is the health and safety requirements for child care providers. The training that Rhonda spoke about, the pre-service health and safety training that we have for all types of providers who care for children whose family are on subsidies, is one step in that direction. But we will also have increased requirements for training, continued training for all folks, all child care providers who are caring for these children. Another big one is our background checks. We do background checks both for licensed child care providers and for license exempt. And we will be required to be doing a fingerprint FBI check on all of those. So for the Office of Child Care at the Early Learning Division, we do about 35,000 background checks a year. And at Department of Human Services, for our license exempt, it's about 7,500. And so it will be a considerable increase in the number of fingerprint background checks. We also are going to be charged with monitoring license exempt facilities. So now we monitor about 4,500 licensed facilities in the state with our licensing system, and then we will add, depending on how we look at it, but it could be up to 2,500 license-exempt homes and relative care.
Will you receive more funding to do that?
No, we do not anticipate any additional funding for the monitoring.
So this is a federal requirement.
It's a federal requirement.
No federal money that comes with this.
Exactly.
Thank you.
It's a federal requirement for use of the federal funds that we get, which is about $66 million a year.
Okay, thank you.
Can I interrupt for a moment?
Yeah.
Just, I find this fascinating because I've been tracking it, but I'm curious, has there been a problem with these homes that you identified as exempt?
We've never done any monitoring of the homes. I think, we may have some complaints that are assessed and investigated, but I would not say as a general rule.
And I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Oh, so just clarifying that you've not really seen a major problem.
Since we don't monitor them, and they self-attest that they meet certain requirements, but we haven't had much.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Another one that's kind of big, and I'm not going to go into any detail, is there's a transparent consumer and provider education information, which basically is going to help parents understand the types of child care they're choosing and also provide them access to full compliance and monitoring history on those facilities that they choose. And then the family-friendly eligibility policy, which I have to say we're all really excited about, and it establishes a 12-month eligibility redetermination period for CCDF, regardless of changes in income, as long as it doesn't go over the 85% threshold. And then temporary changes in work. Right now we have a 1 month period where you can do work search. It will require a 3 month period of work search, so that's pretty exciting for us. And there's also additional activities to improve the quality of child care in the new law. So that's it, that high level. Obviously, there's lots and lots of details that we're looking at, and some of them haven't even been fine-tuned. Over the next year, the Federal Office of Child Care will be developing rules around the new legislation that we will learn about as we go. Many of these requirements will phase in over a 2 to 3 year period, with the exception of the eligibility, and it's going to happen pretty soon, quickly.
Mm-hmm. So, thank you, Kelly.
You bet.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Gumberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Correct me right away if I'm wrong in my facts, but as I understand it, that providers who focus on infants in Oregon are limited to two children, while neighboring states such as California allow three. And if that's correct, I wonder if you could talk to me for a minute about how that lower threshold improves the quality of care that those infants provide, but also how it affects the waiting list, the availability of care, the viability of those small businesses that are accepting kids, and how it would affect child care costs if they have to spread their fixed costs over two clients rather than three.
Mm-hmm. So it's a complicated answer to a simple question. So our licensing system, there's a variety of different types of licensing, and what you're referring to is our registered family child care, where you can care for up to 10 children, but only two of those children can be infants. So you could have, you know, four school-age children and four, I'm not doing the math right, but up to 10 children and a number of preschool and school-age children as and two infants. You know, there's also folks who will apply for an exemption to that rule where they may have three infants. In licensed facilities, you have, it's more about ratio and having X number of caregivers per number of infants. So you can care for four infants per caregiver in some of our certified facilities. So that doesn't really answer your question, but when you're looking at a family child care home and looking at health and safety standards really across the country, Oregon is kind of right in line. And in a certified family child care home, which is a little bit higher quality, you could actually have 16 infants if you have enough caregivers in a child care home. So I would say Oregon kind of falls towards the middle when it comes to the way that we, the strength of our licensing rules. And California, we might not be comparing apples to apples.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Oh, we're so glad you could come. Mike McCormick is going to talk with us about the Oregon's long-term care. And how much time do you need, Mike?
Less than 10 minutes.
Perfect. I love hearing that. Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. For the record, my name is Mike McCormick, and I'm the director for the Aging and People with Disabilities Program within the Department of Human Services. So today I'm going to be using the term long-term care, and when I use that term, I'm referring to the long-term services and support system that's administered under the Aging and Physical Disabilities Program that I oversee. So Senate Bill 21 is a bill that was passed in the 2013 session that required the department to work with stakeholders to develop a plan to modernize and improve our long-term care system. And thanks to a significant amount of legislative investments and policy changes that have been made since that time, we're already well on our way to improving our system of long-term care. So an update on our Senate Bill 21 activities. We formed a 19-member steering committee that consists of 15 consumers, consumer advocates, providers, and four state legislators. We've met 10 times over since the bill's passage. We formed four subcommittees. So the first one we call the assessment subcommittee. It wanted to look at how are we assessing people's needs and are we getting in early enough to potentially develop strategies for prevention. The second committee was data and research. This committee really wanted to focus in on identifying the causes for entry into our long-term care system so that policies could be crafted to potentially reduce future expenditures in that area. Third was the caregiver subcommittee that focused both on how do we develop a workforce to support the needs in the future, as well as how do we support unpaid family caregivers. And finally, service equity subcommittee. Service equity, as we define it within DHS, is about ensuring that individuals have equal outcomes and not just equal access to services, and do our policies support those objectives? So
The steering committee met extensively, had robust discussions, and formed recommendations under the objectives that were stated in Senate Bill 21. So the first objective was develop policies to support consumers' right to stay in their own homes and communities. So we had a very robust debate and discussion about how federal policies still in the year 2014 have a heavy bias towards institutional care. There was a desire to initiate, you know, conversations with the feds about how we can influence those policies to make them more progressive so that consumers have the, you know, the right to access services in home and community-based settings. So for context, in Oregon, in this program, we are serving approximately 86% of our consumers in home and community-based settings, 14% in institutional, yet all federal policies have that heavy institutional bias. How do we, as you know, we're serving 86% of our consumers in home and community-based settings with goals to keep going even further, how are we going to assure access to quality caregivers? How do we continue to improve the coordination of the social healthcare system, which is what we kind of consider the long-term care system, as well as the healthcare system? You may recall that long-term care was carved out of the Oregon Health Authority's Coordinated Care Organization initiative. We're very invested in ensuring the success of that model. So a group has met and formed a lot of recommendations on how we're going to partner with the CCOs on their triple aim objective. And that plan is final, and we're at a point now where we just need to begin to execute it. How do we continue to improve access to technology and adaptive equipment? The innovations have been remarkable in this area, but the state has really lagged behind our implementation, making that equipment available to our consumers of long-term care, and so we need to do a better job in that area.
Say that again. You somehow lost
me there. Adaptive equipment and technology that can help people remain independent in their own homes. You know, things like video conferencing that we don't do could be like one example of that. You know, the personal emergency response systems. We're just really lagging behind on that type of technology. A recurring theme was that we need much better access to transportation. This probably isn't a surprise to this committee, but that came up over and over. Also, we need to develop new models that a person can call their own home. The last time we've had a new licensing category for these types of services was in the 90s with assisted living facilities. And so there's discussion about what are the emerging models? Do we need to have some regulatory oversight of them? Do we want to just develop new concepts that haven't necessarily been imagined yet? So the second objective is how do we support consumers to achieve and maintain their independence? So we need a better emphasis on preventative services. We need improved access towards housing, as you just heard. Housing came up over and over. There's a lot of individuals that are living in community-based care facilities simply because they do not have access, affordable access to independent housing. Also, how do we address social isolation? We have 51% of our consumers today that are being served in their own homes. And we know anecdotally that some of them are suffering from social isolation, even though they've chosen to live in their own home. That's where they want to be, and nothing's going to get them out of that place. They are still suffering from social isolation. Support training and respite for unpaid caregivers. So I give the statistic quite often that about 95% of long-term care is administered by unpaid family caregivers. That is our greatest asset in the state, and we need to have policies that support that wonderful resource that we have, a little money invested in supporting the family caregivers with respite activities, training, those types of things, you know, will pay huge returns on any investment that is made. And finally, on that topic, they were encouraging state policies that would encourage development of age-friendly communities. So to the extent that you have an age-friendly community, one that has shopping, transportation, all of the needs can be met accessibly and in an easy fashion, then independent individuals are going to remain independent for a longer period of time. Finally, the last objective, serve all people and cultures in a culturally and linguistically responsive manner, in a manner that they choose. This is the service equity conversation I initiated. We need a workforce that is capable of meeting the increasingly diverse population of Oregon. There's pockets of the state, you know, where we do not have providers that can communicate because of language difficulties. There are different cultural differences that we've noticed in Oregon, that in some populations it's taboo to request public assistance in caring for a family member. So in these situations, sometimes some of these plans are very strained and difficult to keep together. So how do we reach out to communities, build relationships, and help them keep that family plan together that they want? But that's, you know, a challenging discussion, but that's something that we need to tackle. And finally, we do not have really good service equity data in our programs yet, and there was a strong desire to collect that information, to develop it, so that we know just how we're doing, you know, baseline the information, and then be able to monitor our progress in the future. So right now, we have one final steering committee meeting left in January, where we're going to be reviewing the results of a statewide tour that we took. We're going to be developing, sharing the first draft of the report, and we will be reporting back to the 2015 session with our recommendations.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. Representative Whitson.
I have a question. So will we be developing a nexus, these private families that have caregivers, family caregivers, with the state, requiring unionization or collective bargaining for family members if we start providing money for respite and other things?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, that is not the concept that was envisioned. It was more a concept of how do we support them in their training? Like, especially, there's a lot of family caregivers that are caring for a loved one with dementia. And that is very challenging care, both emotionally as well as technically. So how do you train the family caregiver to serve their own family member? What kind of respite supports do you need to put behind them so that they don't burn out and ultimately end up with the individual remaining in a setting.
So the answer is no?
That is correct. That is not the assumption.
Thank you. Representative Olson, I'm going to call on you too. Representative Olson had knee surgery several months ago, and I had knee surgery 2 months ago, and knee replacement. And this was, I guess, the first time I realized how helpless I was. And how isolated I was. I have my husband, bless his heart. But since then, also, I have a close friend who's developed dementia. This man climbed Mount Hood dozens of times. Another close friend who had a stroke and is living in assisted care. I mean, so much has happened to me all at once, along with my own personal experience of being in pain, not being able to move, being totally dependent on somebody else, something I'd never experienced before. And I would hope that this committee will be following up, because these issues are just going to be increasing geometrically. And I am hoping that this is one of the issues that our committee will take on, realizing this population is going to be growing and it's going to be more needy. Representative Liner.
When I was a Clackamas County Commissioner, one of the things that Cindy Becker, our Director of Health and Human Services, did such a good job of, and I think you did a really good job of it just now, so I wanted to thank you, is naming how the infusion of little bits of money to help people stay in their own homes and stay under the care of a family member rather than going into an institutional setting, how that can be so cost-saving, you know, good for human beings and their morale and their quality of life, but also, you know, as we look at a big increase in the number of very aged seniors over the next 20, 30 years, it seems like a financial imperative that we invest in some efforts like that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Madam Chair, a follow-up to her question. Oregon Project Independence is one of the main groups that people know. Do you contract with them and other groups like that to try to support and train caregivers? How do you do that?
Okay, so Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, the legislature just made an incredible investment using the special purpose appropriation for senior funds. They invested, it's either $3.3 or $3.5 million towards offering free training to all caregivers throughout all regions of Oregon. Some of the topics that are the dementia and, I mean, Alzheimer's and related dementia curriculum that's out there is nothing short of magnificent. It is comprehensive. It's available to every Oregonian free of charge. It's also available to paid caregivers in adult foster homes, nursing facilities, etc. That was one-time funding. The continued funding was not included in the governor's recommended budget. I've heard stakeholders in our community express a desire for ongoing funding. That would be one area. Also, there is some limited training dollars within our Older Americans Act programs, which are administered through our local area agencies on aging. So Oregon Project Independence does not specifically provide that type of training, but we do provide extensive case management, which can really help out families. Case management, I do not consider administrative activity. It's really working with the individual on trying to develop a plan that'll meet their needs.
Thank you so much, Mike. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, one question, comment, I think, is that it's sort of a social work axiom that 20% of the help people get comes from the formal system and 80% comes from non-formal systems, right? But I want to make sure, I mean, I'm really very concerned about workforce development, and I want to make sure that 20% from the formal side really does get the kind of support that's needed, whether it's wages or training and so on. But I think your idea about emphasizing training for that 80% is right on.
And Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, we also have a major workforce recruitment initiative that we have just started, and that is going to be kicking off in the new year on how do we recruit more quality employees into this workforce.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you,
and
Chair Tomei.
This committee will call on Mike more in the future. Okay, Shannon, you're last on today. Thank you so much for waiting. Both of you are coming up. How nice. Our cup overflows.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, committee members. I'm Shannon Savell. I'm the Director of Crime Victim Services Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. And I'm here, I think, to give a very brief update on the position that was given to my division to address the commercial sexual exploitation of children.
Yes.
So we had engaged in an MOU with the Oregon Health Authority. They granted us the remainder of funds that were provided to them in the last legislative session. It amounted to approximately $273,000. And we have posted a position description and job posting for a CSEC intervention coordinator. It was supposed to close on the 16th. However, we're going to extend it through the end of the month. That's not related to how many people have applied. It's just simply we're hearing that in December it's a really good month to leave things open a little longer as people are making plans for the coming year. We are on target to convene an advisory committee after the first of the year.
Great.
And my hope is that I've been speaking to some of the people in the community that you had recommended, particularly Chair Tomei, Professor Carey. And we've spoken about the possibility of using the excess funds in community grants to regions around the state, maybe to work on this issue or to convene their own coordinating committees to work further on CSEC. We're looking at that. That's just one of the many ideas that are in the hopper, if you will. But we are on target and hoping to have an actual tangible results by the end of January and moving forward. The only thing I would note is that the position is limited duration because these were funds that were provided to OHA, I believe, in the last legislative session from the general fund. So we are advertising, if you will, or trying to recruit a highly qualified, experienced professional who has experience working in law enforcement and the nonprofit arena, perhaps not equally in both, but has worked with folks in both of those arenas, who's aware of the CSEC issues, preferably someone who's fluent in the model that's developed in Multnomah County. What I'm ultimately getting to is that we're looking for a highly qualified individual, and it could be a little complicated to try to persuade them to join us on a limited duration basis. My understanding was that Representative Huffman was going to be considering taking up the cause on this, to be looking for a little bit of extra money maybe in the next biennium to see if we can continue funding for this position. We will also be enthusiastically pursuing grants.
Yes. And Representative Gilliam, I know one of the big issues you've pushed through the years is to get the nonprofits and the faith community involved in these issues. And we know that they're very interested in these issues. So we're trying to develop. That's one of the reasons why it was so important to set up this what am I trying to say?
The fund?
Yes, mm-hmm. Right. So that people can be raising private funds to support this in a very unified way, not just some little funds here for this house and funds for this house, the whole program looking at this program.
If we weren't speed dating, I would comment.
Great. Well, yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Margaret Scott. Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I am the division director at Morrison Child and Family Services and program director for our CSEC residential program, which I am pleased to say will be open on December 29th. We had all of our staff, most of our staff start on Monday, and they're undergoing a couple weeks of training, and then there's Christmas, which complicates things. We now have enough staff hired that we could have 9 girls in the program for a while. We still are looking for additional milieu counselors, particularly overnight people, but we're well on our way. We're very excited, and that's my update. We are also actively seeking foundations to do some grants. I'm meeting with someone today, as a matter of fact, so we can sort of get as much as we can to do as much as we can for the kids. So
that's great. After working on this for several years, it really is very, very exciting.
Very exciting.
To open up by the end of the year. That's wonderful. So thank you for your hard work, both of you, and for all the people who worked on this for so long.
Thank you.
Any questions, comments?
Where is it located?
I don't think we're supposed to give the exact location.
It's in Portland. Portland, okay.
Yeah,
I just meant sort of region of the state.
Right. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for championing the cause. It's meant a lot. It's been really a pleasure to work with this committee and with you. So thank you.
Thank you. It's been very exciting for me. Thank you. Okay, with that, now we have summary of potential bills. Representative Olson, I think, and so
Jill Gray may be here with DHS.
Okay, Jill. Is Jill here? Oh, there you are, Jill. Okay. And then I know Representative Olson, you have one?
I got three.
Okay. You've got three? Okay.
Well, pick
and
one.
And then we have committee bills, right?
And we can just discuss
committee
that.
Committee
concepts. Then go to work session.
Okay. So we're not going to be voting on this, on any of these. We're just going to be hearing briefly about them. And
Do you want
us to step aside while you two communicate?
No, I was just going to say I also have one. If people are having an opportunity to speak briefly about theirs, I may not have responded to your query in time.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
Thanks.
Okay, briefly.
All right. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Jill Gray, and I'm a legislative coordinator for Department of Human Services, and one of the program areas I'm assigned to is the self-sufficiency program. And so I'm here this morning to talk about the two LCs we have prepared for the 2015 session for self-sufficiency. So I will just jump right in.
And very briefly.
The first one, and we provided these, so they should be in OLIS for you to review. The first one is LC 465. This LC has to do with notice requirements for SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And very briefly, this LC came, the genesis of it came out of the federal government shutdown from October of last year. During the shutdown, we were not receiving payments from the federal government on the SNAP program. And so we had enough money on hand to continue issuing benefits for the month of October, but starting November, we did not have enough funds to continue issuing benefits. In Oregon, we have a 10-day notice requirement, which means that we must provide notice to recipients 10 business days before a potentially adverse impact to their benefit. So we knew that starting about early to mid-October, we were going to have to start preparing for this mass notification to go out to SNAP recipients saying that benefits would stop November 1st. So we drafted the notice, we translated it, we printed all the notices, we processed them, we were ready to go. We were just about ready to hit send when Congress did resolve the federal government shutdown. Unfortunately, by that point, we had already spent about $150,000 processing or preparing those notices. And that brings us to LC 465. This particular LC would change the notice requirement, but only for the very limited circumstance of a federal mass change, such as a federal government shutdown. And in that case, we would follow the federal minimum notification requirements. Those federal minimum notification requirements allow much more flexibility in timing for us, so we could get much closer to the date of when something may actually or may not actually happen, so that hopefully we reduce the risk of this happening again, where we're spending time and energy and resources on notices that we never have to mail out. I will let everybody know that we've talked to different groups of our stakeholder and advocate community. One of the concerns we've expressed is that it has a very narrow focus. It's only in the limited circumstance of a federal mass change. And yes, that is our intent as well. And I know in we are pressed for time, so I will just go right on to the next one. We were having some technical difficulties. I believe this next LC actually didn't make it into OLIS, but we will resend to make sure that it gets in there for everybody to see. It is LC 467. This particular LC has to do with TANF, for the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. And there are some decisions about how the TANF program currently operates that were made during the recession or shortly thereafter. And we're at a different point, both the state and the TANF program, than we were during the height of the recession. And now is a good time to take a look at TANF and make some decisions about how, what changes, what improvements to the TANF program we should make. We have had several different work groups, work teams might be a better description of them, that includes not only DHS staff, but also our partners, advocates, stakeholders that have been meeting over the last several months on topics ranging from improved client engagement all the way to enhanced partnerships with the workforce, healthcare, early learning systems. It's still a work in progress. There's still work continuing on it. I know that committee members probably have a lot of questions, and that's perfectly fine. We are more than happy to come back in at a later date and talk in much more detail about this legislative concept. For today, we just wanted to highlight for everyone that there will be a TANF bill in 2015, and we will be back here before the legislature to have this conversation about what is a successful TANF program look like, so that we have very successful outcomes for the families we're serving.
Thank you, Jill.
Yeah.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Lois Day. I'm the Director for Child Welfare at the Department of Human Services, and I have two LCs I just wanted to bring to your attention. One is a mandatory reporting clarification. All employees of the Department of Human Services are mandatory reporters, and recently this LC would clarify that an employee of the Department of Human Services who fails to perform the duties of mandatory reporting would be subject to dismissal. Recently, we've had some cases where state courts and arbitrators have set aside actions to dismiss employees for failure to report, and failure to report is really contrary to the mission of the department as a whole, and this would provide a statutory fix now that we have that precedent. The second one is to provide additional clarity for when the department can release information on finalized adoptions. Last session, I believe there was a statute that did clarify when petitioners, birth parents, or adoptees can receive their record, their court records. What this concept does, it provides an ability for adult adoptees and parents of minor siblings to search for genetic siblings to the children and register for the mutual consent registry. And it authorizes the department to actually release the county in which the adoption was finalized so they know where to go and get those records. At this time, the statute is ambiguous around whether or not we can do that, and we'd like to have that clarity. Those
okay.
are our two.
Thank you very much.
You're Thank
welcome.
You.
Okay.
Questions? I wish you wouldn't.
Thank you. Because they'll be coming for committees. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Next we have. Pardon? Representative Olson. Okay. Neil, talk about your. You have three concepts.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, committee members, my fellow Americans.
Wow.
I have three. Three concepts, LCs, that I'm going to introduce, but they have all kind of surfaced as a result of our work group that we had with the program integrity issue last year. One of them deals with lottery winnings and sharing that information when a client of DHS wins big, and actually the threshold will be $1,000. Right now, there is no connection where there's no responsibility for lottery to share that information and then also to adjust possibly the benefits then that DHS has. That's an issue that DHS is interested in wanting to try to do in an effort, again, toward program integrity. So that will be one of the LCs that will be moved forward. The other one also deals with lottery winnings, but this one here is a little different. And what it does is it creates an avenue for a lottery to share winnings with DHS. And this concept would establish a data match process identifying lottery winners who are delinquent in paying benefits, overpayments. And right now the state has an opportunity to recover an estimated about $209,000.
Wow.
So, again, this is just a real simple thing, but it's one of those things where I really appreciate Department of Human Services. Jill has been huge in helping me with crafting some of this, as well as Lisa Wendt. God bless her heart.
Yeah.
She's gone.
She's in a good place.
And some others as well.
She's in a good place.
I didn't say that. Then the last one, really quick. Deals with the Oregon Trail card, the EBT card, and that is printing the names on the cards. And that's something that we'd heard quite a bit at length that, if you remember 2 years ago, we kind of were looking at a House bill that would put a photo on it. It made more sense, actually, to put the name on it because it breaks down the barrier for communication between the fraud investigative unit for DHS and that of law enforcement. But it also is going to, I think, really move toward, again, the program integrity. So
okay.
Those three.
Good. So those are your personal bills, right, that will come to this committee?
Yes.
Okay. But we don't have any. Anne, sure.
Yes, thank you. I have a personal bill that I think would come to this committee. It is about preserving affordable apartment units in Oregon, and in the process protecting about $17 million in federal rent subsidy that we get each year to help house very low-income Oregonians. It was brought to me by some affordable housing advocates at Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. The idea is there are about 200 apartment building owners in Oregon who are part of a very specific federal rent subsidy, federal mortgage subsidy program. And the bill would ask that they provide a year of advance notice of intent to exit the affordability program and sell the buildings and have those potentially converted to market rates. So essentially, folks who want to keep the apartments affordable, nonprofits generally, would have a chance to try to put together the money to buy them out at market rates, but by keeping them affordable to preserve this huge amount, $17 million in federal rent subsidy. So I'll share more about it later, but I think it builds on some important foundation investments
that have been made over the last 5, 6, 7 years nationally and locally in Oregon, and a lot of good work, and hopefully we'll be able to find a good path forward for this.
Great. Thanks. Sounds like a great bill. Do you have something, Representative
Collins? Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very quick. I've got two things that probably come this direction. One of them is eliminating non-refundable deposits, which sounds like an oxymoron and is, but is used frequently in the rental environment. The other one is a bill I've drafted at the request of the Humane Society, which would eliminate the practice of renters requiring that that cats be declawed in order to be able to rent. That means actually removing their fingers down to the second knuckle, or having dogs debarked, removing their vocal cords in order to be able to rent.
Yeah. Interesting. And the other one that you had brought, at least your staff had brought it to my staff, was transportation for disabled and elderly, and I know that was an issue.
Yeah.
We had suggested you send it to the Transportation Committee,
right.
But also it could certainly be discussed.
Good possibility.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any others possible? Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a bill. Actually, Christy has a PowerPoint. It's about a half an hour.
Oh, yeah. Turn it on.
Regarding elder abuse against aging statues in the Capitol. No, we have three bills, and I won't go into them, but just so you know, the Task Force on Elder Abuse Prevention is continuing. I don't know where they'll be assigned, but we're going deeper and trying to do a little more each session and more soon.
That's great. Good. Good. Anything else? All right. And no committee bills. Are we through?
No, we got 5 committee bills.
Oh, okay. Okay, we'll close the hearing. We'll go into a work session.
Describe them briefly.
Briefly, very briefly.
Thank you, Chair. You have 5 committee bills.
And before he does this, there won't be any debate on this. We'll just, what I'm hoping to do is just vote on the package of bills. And that doesn't mean you support them if they may not even come to committee. But even if they do, it doesn't mean that you're committed to supporting them.
Okay. So you do have 5 of them. 954 is a placeholder for general assistance pilot. 1738 permits Multnomah County to use proceeds from tax sales of real property for enumerated public purposes. 1791 is a placeholder related to child victims of commercial sexual exploitation. 1799, placeholder related to lottery games. 1839 is a placeholder related to Housing and Community Services. And the last one, 1840, is a placeholder related to Department of Human Services.
Okay,
so you have 6 of them, I'm sorry.
Okay, so can you help me make the motion?
You can vote on them individually or?
No.
And block if you'd like.
Block.
Yes. Leadership.
No. Peaceful, Madam Chair. I move that the following LCs, 954, LC, dated 8/18/14, LC 1738, dated 11/6/14, LC 1791, dated 10/6/14, LC 1839, dated 9/9/14, LC 1799, dated 10/10/14, and then also LC 1840, dated 8/9/25/14. Be considered as committee bills.
So the vice chair has moved that the legislative concepts as recited be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Say no, thank you. Is any objection? If not, the concepts are introduced as committee bills. Okay? With that, they are introduced. What else?
That's all.
Oh, that's all? My gosh, 7 minutes left? Woo, 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 woo. Okay, since I've got 7 minutes, I've got to tell you. I mean, the 14 years I've been in the legislature have been very interesting, but the 8 years that I've been chair of this committee has been one of the most wonderful experiences I've had in my life, and I want to thank all of you. I want to thank staff. I want to thank my good vice chairs, especially my vice chair who's hung in with me from the very beginning, and he said he has had my back, and I believe it. So thank you all. Thank you for this committee. Thank you, staff. Christy has been here for a long time, and Rick, who was actually the committee person, one of the interims. So thank you all. Thanks for all of the people who have have been coming before this committee to testify and have done such wonderful things. I think this committee is the best committee and most productive in the building. It is, what we do is so important because it affects the most vulnerable people in our state, and what we can do help them is going to, it's going to get to a bigger place in heaven, Representative Gilliam. So thank you so much, and with that,
can we comment, Madam Chair?
Sure.
I just want to thank you for your leadership. It's been fabulous being on this committee. I do think it's the heart and soul of a lot of what we do in the legislature and supporting families in Oregon to really thrive. And you've had an incredible, both a strict touch on all of us, like you want us to arrive on time and not be looking at electronics unless we're taking notes, pay attention to people, show respect to the people that come here. You're one of the loudest voices in setting those expectations. I really appreciate that. And at the same time, you have a very soft touch and being so gracious and thanking the people that do make tremendous effort to come down here. So you've been just a fabulous leader, and we're really sad to see you go, even if we're happy for you. I think you forgot the two words there, but we're happy for you that you're going on to other adventures in your life. But you're, as many people have said here, your spirit will continue to live on in this committee and the legislature as a whole very, very strongly.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate hearing that. Thank you. Well, you've been great. And Representative Gelster has been with me from the very beginning, with your first term when you served with me on that, my first committee.
Yeah. And that's been a pleasure. It was great to be trained up into the legislature on this committee by you as a chair, and it was your first session chairing. We had our committee party at Representative Gilliam's house.
Right.
I hope our photos are still hanging on your walls. That was that was a very nice time. I've just really appreciated your commitment and work on the committee to finding a path to get things done. And I have especially appreciated your willingness to push very hard on the expectations around community-based mental health services. And I hope that this committee, however it's configured next session, will continue to do that. And as you said, make clear that many of these requirements are not aspirational. They are really about meeting the basic health care needs of Oregonians that are very valuable to our communities. And you've really set that expectation and kept this issue at the forefront. And I think really shaped by your voice the way that we're moving related to mental health. So thank you so much for that consistency.
And we're hoping that you're going to carry that on into the Senate. We're looking for that. And thank you, Representative Gilliam was also from, since my, you've been every year since 07, right? Since the 07 session?
I was just going to comment on something you said about that. I think you were chair the whole time. I
was oh, that's, six, oh my four. God, he was co-chair.
A period. It's fine. It's certainly forgettable.
Thank you for the correction.
My hands are just now recovering from when you grab the gavel from me every day. But you brought up something that, and let's just be clear, you brought up a theological discussion a moment ago. And I have to say this, and I probably won't get through it. But it is difficult for me to believe that you were legislative atheist of the year. And I'm not arguing with you, and I'm not criticizing you. Give me a moment. But the spirit that you show and the care in all the things you do that drive me crazy of people who are most vulnerable has reminded me of the person that I try to follow, and it's Jesus. So you may have gotten that award, but I see your faith anyway, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Representative, I don't know if you remember the first time I met you was in the winter of 2005, and it was my husband's first session here, and we were at a dinner in Ashland with you and your husband, and you impressed me so much at that time because you were so kind to us, and you were always kind to me when I was in the building, and I was new and I didn't know anyone. I'd had both my hips replaced and I could barely get around. You always had a hug for me. Mm. And I have never forgotten that. And I thank you very much for your kindness over the years.
You're certainly welcome. And I was so pleased when you came on our committee. So thank you for serving.
I guess I should say something, too.
Yes, you should.
I don't know if you remember when we first met.
I do.
You do, really? Oh, my goodness. I think it was like 1972.
Yes.
And, yeah.
71.
71. But, yeah. And so I've followed you throughout your career. So I really can appreciate all the good work you've done throughout the years. And I'm sure you're going to go on and do more. So we're anxiously awaiting to see what you do.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you. Joe and I were in graduate school together. That's where we met. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well,
you feel like everything's been said, but not everybody's had a chance to say it. I'm just not sure if people realize how intimidating it is to come into a committee like this as a freshman member. The scope of issues, the pace that we follow, and I have on more than one occasion heard the chair referred to behind her back as Taskmistress Tomei.
I've never heard that.
And I don't really feel like you're leaving. I've heard all day long about how your spirit is going to remain here, and I feel like I'm going to be looking over my shoulder every time we schedule an information hearing. But the comments that we heard from the witness stand today were not just informational, but there was a certain remarkable degree of respect that I don't see every place in this building, but I certainly saw here today. And I have to say it's so well earned, and we will certainly miss you and your guiding hand on the gavel. The representative from the Christmas Tree District and I will be meeting later to talk about revising the statue legislation. but I do so appreciate your good work here and your driving force and the pace and the scope and the so many accomplishments that are to your credit.
Thank you, David. I appreciate that, Mr. Vice Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm not done. We're not done yet. This would be really quick. I have thoroughly enjoyed working with you. It's been 10 years now. Only six of it's been here. And I appreciate having been your vice chair each time. I've really enjoyed, which I'm not going to share with anybody, our phone calls and conversations the last few months, over the knee issues.
So do I. You oversee my time.
But two things. I want everybody to, and Sarah, you'll remember this as well as Vic, the WWF, the Women's Wrestling Federation, that started in 2007. And you were the chair. You're right, though. It was one of the very best committees we've ever seen. I've seen in here. Yeah. I love judiciary, but this was good. It was like you almost kind of reached right out and grabbed people's hearts and brought it in. Let's talk about it. Let's see what we can do to get things fixed. And then the other thing is, I don't know if we'll be in this room next year or not, but the ghost of Tomei will be here. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. You can see why I love this committee.
May I say a thing to you? At the retreat we have, the Democrats have a retreat coming up. And as a new person, but not as new as the newest, I'm going to be one of a couple people talking about stuff that we've learned or that we wish we would have known coming in. And one of the things I plan to talk about is how you are a role model for how we should try to be as legislators. Because as you saw today, you always act with integrity, you always treat other people with dignity, always, and you always put the importance of the work above your own ego, and that's really good.
Thank you. Debbie, I'm going to have to get a copy of this. Oh, this is so sweet, you guys. Thank you. Thank you, and thanks to staff. And Cheyenne has been our staff this year. But Rick is sort of the head of the staff, committee staff, and Christy, of course, has been here for a long time. Staff is so wonderful.
Well, let me just say, too, on behalf of committee services, you've been a great chair. I've known you from the beginning, and I think we've all missed you a lot. Hopefully, we'll see you back in here, maybe on that side of the table.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys. You've certainly made my day. Thank you so much. And with that, we will close the House House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Thank you. Thank you.